Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired!
In the nearly year and a half since Colin Kaepernick first took a knee, we've learned a lot about the NFL, and by extension, the nation. For one, we've learned that for all our lofty talk about respecting our differences, it is only rhetoric. As a nation, we seem ill-equipped to handle much above the taste great, less filling debate. We learned over the weekend that no less a national treasure than retired Dodger announcer Vin Scully has succumbed to the tired trope that kneeling during the national anthem is an insult to the military. Scully, who used to announce NFL games on television, told a Southern California audience that he won't watch another game because of the protests. To be clear, Kaepernick and other players have repeatedly said, apparently to no avail, that the kneeling has nothing to do with the military or the flag, but instead to bring awareness to police brutality and inequality. Indeed, if anyone believed that professional football, the great national obsession, was somehow the vehicle to handle reasoned discourse on what dissent and patriotism mean in 2017, well, the league's gutless reaction to Donald Trump's bullying put that notion to rest. And now we may find out just how gutless Commissioner Smilin' Roger Goodell and the 32 NFL owners are and have been over this issue. Kaepernick and the NFL Players Association have filed a grievance with an arbitrator, alleging that his failure to land a job in the league stems from collusion between the league's owners. To prove his case, Kaepernick and the union's attorneys are seeking to depose Goodell and members of his staff, as well as team officials. The guest list, if you can call it that, may include as many as 9 owners or CEOs, including Steve Bisciotti of the Ravens, the Cowboys' Jerry Jones, and Bob McNair of the Houston Texans, among others. You'll recall that it was Bisciotti who asked for the counsel of fans over whether the Ravens should bring in Kaepernick during training camp. More recently, Jones declared that any of his players who took a knee during the anthem would find themselves benched. And it was revealed that during a recent NFL meeting, McNair said the league couldn't give the perception that the inmates were running the prison. McNair, who's given more money to Republican candidates than any other owner, immediately apologized for mangling the idiom, claiming he wasn't referring to players, but to league staff. McNair's comments touched off another round of many protests from players, who claim that the owners have no real interest in hearing their concerns, but want to suppress their protest so as not to offend the bottom line. Kaepernick will likely have a difficult time proving that there was a unified effort of the 32 teams not to hire him. The league's owners may be craven, but they aren't stupid. But think of all the hard feelings that could have been avoided, both in the football realm and around the nation itself, if just one of them had brought in Kaepernick and given him a job. Belligerent and embarrassed isn't much better than craven and stupid, and it's no way to go through life or to run a football team. And that's how I see it for this week.
Mariah Carey has been accused of sexual harassment by her former security guard. Now, Michael Anello, who is the CEO of Los Angeles-based Anello Security and Consulting, is actually threatening to sue Carey for unpaid bills in excess of $220,000 for work undertaken between June 2015 and May 2017. Further, a draft lawsuit that was obtained by TMZ, prepared by Anello's lawyer, alleges sexual and verbal harassment, including calling him a skinhead, among other slurs. He alleges on one occasion she was wearing a sheer negligee, and Anello said that he tried to excuse himself, but Carey insisted that he move the luggage that he was moving at the time in her room, and then he left the room. So, obviously, these are all allegations that are happening right now. And I think in the midst of all of the Harvey Weinstein sort of fallout and all of these other famous people in Hollywood being, you know, sort of brought down by sexual harassment and sexual abuse claims and allegations, this is adding to the list with a little bit of a twist, right? Oftentimes, in a lot of these cases, we've seen women accusing men of these actions, and now this sort of flips the table. What do you guys think about this?
go for it. I feel like I jump in like immediately.
No, go ahead.
If you're sexually harassing people, I think the accusation should come forward and we should investigate it and find out who it is, regardless of the gender of the person who's, you know, perpetrating allegedly this sexual harassment.
Yeah, I think some of the claims are going to need to be a little bit more specific. Mariah Carey is always in a negligee. I've never not.
He watched her music video.
Yeah, I've never not seen her almost naked. So, it's probably also the laziest sexual harassment that based on her performances. It's got to be really bad. But yeah, again, harassment of any form has to be taken seriously. Folks need to come forward. He needs to file this so it can be further investigated.
Yes. Yes. I agree with you guys, right? Like, it's very important to recognize that sexual harassment and sexual abuse happens to men, too. And I think that is an important sort of nuance to a lot of the allegations that we're seeing in the media right now. That said, there's a lot going on here. He's unpaid. He is saying that she's racist. One of the things that he said was that she was racist because she wanted to be surrounded by black guys and not white people. First of all, reverse racism, not a thing. Okay, so that's like the first thing.
I never understand that. I don't understand what that means. Like, what does reverse racism, not a thing, mean?
Yeah, so when you were talking about, like, an ism, right? Okay, so, like, sexism, racism, whatever it is, you're looking at, and you can do a better job at this because you're a sociologist, but you're often looking at, like, the oppressor and oppressed historically. You're looking at historical context and things like that. And so when you look at that dynamic and the systemic problems, right, there's going to be individual biases and stereotypes and things like that. But when you're looking at it on a systemic level, you can't, like, the oppressed can't be racist or sexist against the oppressor.
But what if she's like, I hate white people because they're just inherently inferior to me, so I don't want them around me.
Right, like I said, there can be sort of like an individual that can feel that way, but it's not like the whole racism because it's not a systemic problem.
I get what you're saying. I think those words... Yeah, I get it. You have to take into consideration the historical legacy of oppression systems that have been happening since slavery, you know. But it's like, if she's being racist toward white people, like, she can be racist toward white people, right? I can be, you know, I as a Jew can be racist toward people who have oppressed me in the past.
Yeah, I think it's just the way we're using these terms.
Yeah.
And I think that's, we get caught up in how we, you know, kind of semantics around these things. She's displaying bigoted behavior. She's saying things that are racist. She may be discriminating in this particular case because it is the workplace.
Right.
Which I think gets problematic because you should exert some kind of control over who is hired. If you do have that issue, then why is it on display in these kind of interpersonal interactions when he's an assistant, a bodyguard?
A bodyguard.
Okay, yeah. Then you exert some control over who is being hired. Not to say that she's not just openly discriminating by not actively hiring white people. I don't know. And I feel like her ethnicity is also kind of ambiguous. So this is all just kind of like an interesting case. In any light, I think all forms of discrimination or harassment need to be investigated and taken seriously. It's just a little nebulous here as to kind of what has happened. And I think that's why it's just a little tricky to kind of suss out.
We will build the wall. We need it. We need it. We have to stop the drugs from flowing in.
And now a story about what happens when two people experience the same thing. One person sees the experience as discrimination. The other does not. According to a new survey from NPR, the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Latinos born in the U.S. are more likely to say they've experienced racial discrimination than Latinos who came to this country. NPR's Adrian Florido has the story.
Valerie Bosso's parents left their native Peru for Utah 30 years ago. She was born in Salt Lake City that same year. She's lived there her whole life in a mostly white neighborhood. She remembers about a decade ago when immigrants in the area were on edge because agents were conducting immigration raids across the city.
And my mom was at a soccer game with my brother. And a parent asked my mom if she was illegal. And to me, that's clearly a racist question and a racist assumption.
Her mom saw it as a harmless comment, but Bosso was furious.
I said, here we are, kind of just like any other family, playing soccer. And I remember pointing that out, like, no matter what we do, we'll always be seen as other or different. And her saying, well, it's kind of a hot-button issue, and it's in the news.
Bosso says it's always been like this in her family. She notices subtle ways that the white people in her community, nice as they may be, remind her family that it doesn't truly belong. Her mom thinks she's making a big deal about it.
Because for her, she's not from Salt Lake. I don't think she would ever say she's a Utahn, even though we've lived here 30 years. So I can see how that might be a difference in how she perceives things versus how I perceive things.
That difference is why Bosso says her mom didn't see any point in being interviewed for this story. She's never been subjected to discrimination, she said, so what was there to say? NPR's survey found that Latinos born in the U.S. were nearly twice as likely as immigrant Latinos to say that someone had used a racial slur against them or made negative assumptions or comments toward them because of their race or ethnicity.
You know, that's not an unusual finding.
Emilio Parrado is a sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania. He says there are so many possible explanations for this gap in perception. One, he says, is that U.S.-born Latinos may actually experience more discrimination. As they gain education, better pay, better jobs, they come into competition with the dominant racial group.
And so it's in that competition that the dominant group reacts with discrimination.
Another way to explain why immigrants report less discrimination?
So when you ask immigrants that first arrive, they don't understand race relations in the U.S. With Latinos, it's very clear because there are no Latinos in Latin America. You're Argentinian, I'm Argentinian, you're Chilean, you're Colombian.
But in the U.S., many non-Latinos don't see those distinctions. They just see Latinos, not from here. Parrado says immigrants may start to notice they're treated differently, but not really know why.
Immigrants tend to think that it's their own fault. It's because they don't know the rules, it's because they don't know English. But the children of immigrants, they know that it comes from ethnicity and not from a behavior of immigrants.
Karina Ramirez understands this. She grew up in the States.
I currently live in West Palm Beach, Florida.
She says she's been followed around in fancy department stores and thinks it's because she's Latina. Her mother, Fabiola Hidalgo, has had similar experiences, but didn't think it was because of how she looked. She remembers one time when she was waiting in line at a bank. When it was her turn, a white man cut right in front of her, despite protests from the bank tellers. Hidalgo says she stayed quiet, but back in her car, she cried.
I lloré porque yo me sentí tan mal, me sentí como lo último.
I felt like the lowest person in the world, she said. And yet she said she didn't pay much more attention to it. She'd just arrived in the U.S., she didn't speak English, and assumed she must have done something wrong. Her daughter Karina gets emotional hearing her mother tell the story.
I got sad for a second.
How come?
So when she started telling me about, you know, these instances that she lived, it's almost like, again, you know, I wasn't there to stand up for her, to defend her.
Ramirez says she now feels like it's her responsibility to point out the ways that racism, even subtle discrimination, affect her mother's life. Her mother says that thanks to her daughter's lessons, she's learning and, unlike before, is starting to speak up. Adrian Florido, NPR News.
Haiti, the people who are called Haitians, predominantly are people who are classified as non-white, but they're not supposed to ever have anything under the system of white supremacy except punishment.
The Trump administration is expected to announce next week a decision on the fate of immigrants who have been granted visas under what's called Temporary Protective Status, or TPS. There are around 50,000 Haitians living in the U.S. with this protected status. The Trump administration says conditions in Haiti have improved since that country's devastating 2010 earthquake, and he says those improvements mean there's no reason to extend the visas. I should say the administration says that. Carrie Kahn just came back from a reporting trip in Haiti, and she's with us now. Carrie, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about what you saw on the ground. UN peacekeeping troops have now withdrawn from Haiti. Are things considerably better? Have things improved?
They have, especially if you compare it to the immediate aftermath of the quake 7 years ago. You see reconstruction, you see economic activity. I even saw construction cranes downtown. I have never seen that before. Hmm. The Trump administration says the National Palace has been demolished and point to the UN peacekeeping troops leaving as proof of progress. Yes, the National Palace is down and other government buildings are going up, but if you just go around the corner in downtown Port-au-Prince, it still looks like a disaster zone with crumbled buildings and all goods being sold on the sidewalk in front of those buildings. So it's the UN withdrawal has left a huge challenge for Haitian police. So there's a lot that is concerning Haitians right now, especially the alarming poverty and the homelessness rate.
You had a long interview with Haiti's new president, Jovenel Moïse. What did he say about the prospect of 50,000 Haitians returning to Haiti from the U.S., possibly as early as January?
He's very concerned. And I asked him that exact question. And let's just play a little bit of what he said.
Well, c'est sûr que Haïti pas paré pour recevoir 50,000 Haïtiens aujourd'hui.
Sure, Haiti is not ready to receive 50,000 Haitians. If they have to return to Haiti, they are our brothers and sisters, and we will welcome them back here.
He's concerned about the loss of money that the Haitians living abroad send home. He gave us a startling figure that remittances by Haiti is 25% of the country's GDP.
Wow.
It's a quarter of all Haitian entire output. He said he was expecting $2.5 billion next year, and that's the same as Haiti's total annual operating budget. And he said he's encouraging the U.S. to look at individual cases, not just to send home all 50,000 Haitians.
Yeah, and keep that money coming into Haiti. You know, you mentioned also that the president wants to reinstate Haiti's army. The army was disbanded in the 1990s after horrific human rights abuses. And I wonder, what has changed? What did the president tell you about why he wants and needs an army now?
He says that the army will be more like a national guard and help in times of national emergencies, especially with the pullout of UN peacekeeping forces that have been in Haiti for more than 13 years. Here's what he said about that.
The
UN could have helped and support the army. So when they were leaving, like after 13 years, we could have like a very professional army. And I'm talking about an army that would be there to do a military coup. No, a very professional army.
That comment about the coup, I followed up on that with him because there's much concern that he's reinstating the army as a way to protect himself from the political turmoil or a possible coup. And I asked him, is that why he was doing it? And he said, absolutely not. The new army will be there only to help the Haitian people and not to protect him or his rule.
Does the new president seem optimistic about the country's future?
He's very strategic. He kept outlining a 10-point plan for this, a 4-point plan for that. He has a big infrastructure plan that he's working on. But Haiti has so many challenges. I can't say he's optimistic, but I think he's taking up the challenges.
NPR's Carrie Kahn, just back from Haiti. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, see again. The people who classify themselves as white are not happy with their appearance. Now, they've taught us to be unhappy about our appearance. You see, but they're very unhappy about their appearance. I think there's an article in the handout about a woman who was, white woman who was in Hawaii. And she said that being around the Hawaiian people and the Asian people, and she said she was tall and white and pale. She said she felt like a freak. And so then she started getting involved in genetic science.
It's known as butterfly syndrome, an ailment which makes sufferers' skin as fragile as butterfly wings and causes excruciating pain. But now a child in Germany with the condition has been given genetically modified skin covering 80% of his body in a series of life-saving operations. Dr. Anna Martinez is a paediatric dermatologist in the UK, and she says it's a real breakthrough.
I got goosebumps when I heard this. It was just incredible. Today, this treatment is not available, and it's not going to be available in the next few months, but this is a massive advance in research.
Our health correspondent, James Gallagher, told us about the young patient.
Hassan, the name of this child, he was born with a genetic defect, and that stops the layers of his skin sticking together. And what that means is something that if you had a trip or fall, you know, you might have grazed your knee. That is a really serious wound if you've got this condition. Even picking someone up, like hugging a child, can leave you with really severe chronic wounds and blistering. And he had this, you know, the first wounds and blisters appeared in his first week of life.
Now, he's had this treatment. Tell us how he came to have these operations.
He was born in Syria, moved to Germany, and he's had these wounds all of his life. But in 2015, they became incredibly severe. He had an infection, and he had, you describe it, most of his body was like a red, raw, open wound. He was critically ill in hospital. Doctors quite seriously didn't think he was going to survive. But they eventually brought in this team of Italian biologists who were researching gene therapy. And because of the exceptional case, how he was so severely ill, they decided they were going to try this experimental therapy to basically give him a new skin.
And how did that work?
They took a sample of his current skin. Now, that contained the genetic defect that was stopping his skin working properly. So they then shipped that to Italy and modified it. So they infected it with a virus. And you might be going, why are you infecting it with a virus? Well, viruses are incredibly good at getting inside cells. That's their whole meaning in life. But these viruses were used by scientists as like a postman. They were delivering the correct genetic information into those skin cells to make the skin form properly. Once they'd done that, they grew large sheets of skin and then grafted it back onto the patient. It took three operations to cover 80% of his body in this genetically modified skin. Hassan is now doing so spectacularly well. He doesn't look like a traditional child with this condition. He's out running around, playing football. There's a danger that his remaining 20% of his skin might get injured and still have that blistering and wounding. So it is a serious discussion doctors are having about whether he should basically have a 100% replacement.
Now, patients with EB generally don't have a very good prognosis, do they? So how many people might this breakthrough help?
EB is a very wide condition, so there are different forms of EB that all come with different severities, but 500,000 people in the world are estimated to have some form of EB. The question is this going to help them? And that's what we don't know for certain yet, because this is not a proven treatment. It's worked in one case. It's worked in this one child. And doctors were able to do that because it was so exceptional, because he was so severely ill at that time. It will now take clinical trials to actually prove that it works. And it will also take some customization. It will need different approaches for each of the different forms of EB. So it's going to take longer than you might think. This isn't something that's going to be treating people today, tomorrow, next month.
That was James Gallagher.
Does it hurt terribly?
No, it's not too bad. They have me on a lot of painkillers.
Oh, really? What kind? Codeine? Vicodin? Percocet? Fentanyl? OxyContin? Palidone?
I have no idea.
An opioid epidemic is ravaging parts of this country. President Trump has declared it a public health emergency. Last year, overdoses killed some 64,000 people. It's being compared to the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s and 90s. The face of the opioid epidemic has been mostly white. Now, that's because we have seen a massive increase in drug overdoses among young white adults, often in rural areas. But what's been happening in Black and Latino communities? For answers, we called up Dr. Andrew Kolodny. He's co-director of the Opioid Policy Research Collaborative at Brandeis. Dr. Kolodny, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So by the numbers, white communities do seem to be suffering the most from this epidemic or impacted the most. How is opioid addiction affecting Black and Latino communities?
So our new opioid addiction epidemic is sparing African-American and Latino communities. And it's striking when you look at the data, whether you're looking at overdose deaths or emergency room visits for opioid use problems or treatment admissions for opioid addiction. It's very clear that this epidemic is overwhelmingly white, and it begs the question, why? I can share with you a theory, and it is a theory that's based on evidence. Something that we do know is that doctors prescribe narcotics more cautiously to their non-white patients. It would seem that if the patient is Black, the doctor is more concerned about the patient becoming addicted, or maybe they're more concerned about the patient selling their pills, or maybe they are less concerned about pain in that population. But the Black patient is less likely to be prescribed narcotics and therefore less likely to wind up becoming addicted to the medication. So what I believe is happening is that racial stereotyping is having a protective effect on non-white populations.
Are doctors acknowledging that they're less likely to prescribe narcotics, pain medication, to Black and Latino patients?
I don't think they're aware of it. I think this happens on an unconscious level.
This isn't, of course, the first time that the U.S. has faced a drug epidemic. There's crack cocaine in the 80s and 90s. That was often affecting Black communities. Is the response to this crisis different?
Very different.
Why?
What we saw from policymakers, what we got from policymakers, was a message that we could potentially arrest our way out of the problem.
Hmm.
What we got was a war on drugs and a crackdown on crime. What we're seeing now is a very different response now that we've got an addiction epidemic that's disproportionately white. What we're hearing from policymakers, even conservative Republican politicians, when they talk about the opioid crisis, many begin by saying, we can't arrest our way out of this. We have to see that people who are addicted can access effective treatment. We didn't hear that during the crack cocaine epidemic. It's good that we're hearing it now. It's too bad we didn't hear it then.
President Trump, interestingly, has declared this crisis a public health emergency, but not a national emergency. If it was a national emergency, that would allow federal funding, even access to FEMA funds, to go toward treating it. Does this fall short, do you think, of a national emergency? And what's the difference?
Well, you know, I don't know that the problem is so much the type of national emergency or public health emergency that was designated. My concern is that what we haven't received from the Trump administration is a plan for addressing the problem or a request from Congress for funding.
What would a solution, what would a new system look like?
One of the first things that we have to do is we have to prevent more people from becoming addicted to opioids. And that's not lecturing to kids, don't do drugs. More than anything else, that's about promoting much more cautious prescribing so that we don't directly addict patients and so that people don't indirectly become addicted because we've stocked everybody's home with a highly addictive drug. But we also have to recognize now that the genie is out of the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Millions of Americans are suffering from opioid addiction. We have to see that they can access the most effective treatments very easily. If you're opioid addicted, when you wake up in the morning, you're going to need to use an opioid pretty quickly or you're going to be feeling very sick. We want that individual to be able to access effective outpatient treatment more easily than they can access pain pills, heroin, or fentanyl, if that person wakes up and they've got $20 in their pocket and they know where to go get heroin, that is what they're going to do. We want that person to be able to walk into a treatment center, regardless of their ability to pay for their care, and to be started on treatment, outpatient treatment, that same day.
Dr. Andrew Kolodny is co-director of the Opioid Policy Research Collaborative at Brandeis. Dr. Kolodny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Let's delve now into some Seattle history and get a little insight into where it's taken us today. In the 1960s, Seattle, like many cities across America, experienced unrest in the battle for civil rights. Back then, it was uncommon for minorities to work across racial lines. But four local activists became allies that would change the social movement in Seattle. They were called the Gang of Four. From KUW City of Dreams team, Ruby DeLuna spoke with Larry Gossett. He recalls meeting a Spanish teacher at a high school protest and became lifelong friends.
I met Roberto Maestas on March 29, 1968. At that time, he was in the middle of his second year as a Spanish teacher at Franklin High School. On that morning, unbeknownst to him, three black students were unfairly expelled from Franklin High School. One was expelled because he had a fight with a white kid and he didn't even get a chance to present his side, and he was expelled. An hour later, two black students, women, they had their hair in a natural. The principal had not seen a natural before. He immediately expelled them from schools with a note home to their mothers saying, "Until your daughter looks ladylike, she can no longer attend Franklin High School." And that caused an uproar. So all the black students start gathering. Still, Roberto was in his class, not knowing all this. We had been called by black students, said we're about to tear this mother down, and we didn't want that kind of violence. And we gathered the students and got them to agree to have a sit-in. They voted, of course. We went in. Roberto stayed, and the black students start telling me, "This guy is cool. He's really nice to us." And I said, "Cool." And then I went up and introduced myself to him. For the next couple of hours, Roberto asked me about the sit-in, and I took time because he was important, and no other teacher stayed. The next morning, Roberto Maestas went into the teacher's lounge. He said the following, "My name from this day forward is not Bob. It's not Robert. It is Roberto." And that's the only thing I'll respond to. And then they said he turned around and walked out. The teachers were, that was symbolic of the changes, of the impact that sit-in.
That was Larry Gossett remembering his friend Roberto Maestas. They were part of the Gang of Four.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind grows slower. It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rockin', the chip off the block of your favorite Schoolhouse Rockin'.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Traditional public schools in St. Louis have become increasingly racially segregated over the last 26 years. But if you look at just charter schools, you see a different pattern. According to a St. Louis Public Radio analysis of state data, the number of racially segregated charter schools is declining. St. Louis Public Radio's Camille Phillips explains.
When her family moved to St. Louis in 2011, Kira Hudson Banks only looked at homes in the neighborhood surrounding one charter school, City Garden Montessori.
My husband kind of looked at me like, "Why are we only looking in this rectangle?" But it was the Montessori and the makeup and the demographics of the school.
As a psychology professor who specializes in the effects of racial discrimination, Hudson Banks wanted her black sons Avery and August to go to school with other black children. But she didn't want them to go to a segregated school like many of the public schools in St. Louis.
I want them to have a strong sense of their racial identity, and also I value the ability to connect with people across lines of difference.
City Garden Montessori is one of a handful of charter schools that have succeeded in attracting both white families and black families in recent years. The school's executive director, Christy Huck, says that didn't happen by chance.
creating a racially and socioeconomically integrated school was a core part of the mission from the very beginning. And not just diversity for diversity's sake, but as a means to create equity.
Research shows that students do better when they attend schools with a diverse mix of economic and racial backgrounds. But integration is hard to achieve in the city's public schools because more than half of the white children who live in St. Louis do not attend either type of public school, the traditional school district or a charter school. Instead, they're homeschooled or go to a private school. The white families who decide to keep their kids in public school, they tend to choose charter schools. According to a St. Louis Public Radio analysis of building enrollment data, almost half of the white students enrolled in public school in St. Louis attend charter schools, even though the district has twice as many students. Grace Hagen, who is white, says she and her partner sent their daughter Mila to City Garden because they wanted her to be around children from other backgrounds.
There's been a lot of unlearning that we've had to do about dominant culture and our own biases and privileges, and don't want that for Mila if it can be headed off earlier or avoided.
City Garden is one of several charter schools that opened in the city's less segregated central corridor after the state took over St. Louis Public Schools in 2007. With more options to choose from, white families fled the district in large numbers. By the spring of 2017, almost 80% of the district's schools were racially segregated. That doesn't surprise Superintendent Kelvin Adams, but it does concern him.
It's a school issue, but it's also a community issue that has to be addressed by everybody, not just us, meaning the school district. Our schools are open to everybody. Selling those schools to families is a real challenge.
Even though more charter schools are becoming integrated, most charter schools in St. Louis are still segregated. That influenced Hagen's choice of a high school for Mila. She says she enrolled her daughter in a diverse private school, even though the choice bothers her, because she knows not every family has the money to do the same.
Because a place doesn't exist where all of our values can come together as one. If we were to send her to our neighborhood public high school, it would not be integrated at all. I don't think it would meet her needs academically either.
Families that can afford to avoid public school have been doing so for decades. Meanwhile, more than 80% of St. Louis public school students live in poverty, and it's been that way since at least 1991. Adams says that's a loss for the entire city, because more affluent families tend to bring resources to a school that helps all students succeed. I'm Camille Phillips, St. Louis Public Radio.
It's not racism.
If you can't treat someone with dignity and respect, then you need to get out.
A stunning update today on a story we covered in late September. It was a speech heard all around the world, viewed more than a million times on social media. Lieutenant General Jay Silveria received high praise for telling a room full of cadets that racial slurs will not be tolerated at the Air Force Academy. The general was responding to racial epithets, including the N-word, scribbled on these message boards on the doors of five black cadets at the prep school. After a month-long investigation, officials at the school now say it was all a hoax perpetrated by one of the black students. CNN Pentagon reporter Ryan Brown is with me. More on this. And, this was so huge, Ryan. You know, we talked to the general. You had former Vice President Joe Biden, Senator John McCain reacting, you know, at the time. What happened? Who did this? According to the Air Force?
The Air Force, conducting its investigation, found out that one of the supposed victims of these racist messages was, in fact, the perpetrator. And the Air Force Academy issuing a statement following the investigation at the Academy's prep school saying that this individual admitted guilt, and the investigation found that he was, in fact, the culprit. And so, again, this, as you said, launched a strong worded response from the commandant of the Academy, Lieutenant General Silveria. And a lot of buzz. In fact, he encouraged those witnessing his speech to take out their cell phones, to film it, to disseminate it wider. And again, though, now the investigation concluding that it was actually one of the supposed victims who was responsible for these messages.
The general, you know, in talking to him, he was so sincere with us in his resolve, really with everyone in that room, right, to promote a culture of respect at the Air Force Academy. How is he responding to this news?
Well, the general says he stands by his comments. He said that, you know, those words were written. He issued a statement to CNN earlier today saying that, you know, regardless of the circumstances, that those words were written and they needed to be addressed. And so he said, you know, you can never overemphasize the need of a culture of dignity and respect. And so, again, very strong words backing up what he said. And so he stands by his message and thinks it's a powerful message that should be understood by all airmen, both at the academy and wider.
What are you talking about? That's right. We move it to Mississippi, and you know how that's spelled. M-I, crooked letter I, crooked letter I, hump back, I.
It was the wrong body. The finding of a Negro male was noted and forgotten. The search was not for him. The search was for two white youths and their Negro friend.
Well, that is a clip from a 1964 CBC documentary. It's called Summer in Mississippi. And in that film, two U.S. law enforcement officials have found the body of a black teenager in the Mississippi River, the second body of a black teen they'd found in 2 days. The young men were named Henry D. and Charles Moore. They had been murdered by the Ku Klux Klan. But as you heard in that old film, the bodies were merely noted and forgotten. Those weren't the bodies they were looking for. That was a scene that the Canadian documentary maker David Ridgen could never forget after he saw it. And 40 years after it was filmed, Dave Ridgen set out to investigate. His work, together with Thomas Moore, the brother of one of the victims, forced the FBI to reopen the case. It ultimately led to the arrest and conviction of one of the Klansmen, James Ford Seal. It also cemented Dave Ridgen's interest in investigating cold cases. He helped found the Civil Rights Cold Case Project. He is also the host of the CBC podcast Someone Knows Something. 6 episodes of season 3 of SKS are out today, and they delve back into that Mississippi cold case, the issues it raises around white supremacists and the American justice system remain as relevant as ever. David Ridgen is with me in our Toronto studio. Hi.
Hello.
Well, first of all, you made sure that Henry D. and Charles Moore were not forgotten. Remind us who these two were.
Well, Charles Moore was a 19-year-old college student at Alcorn College in 1964 in the spring. He had just been suspended for taking part in a protest, so he was actually around Meadville, Mississippi, where he was picked up by the Klan. And Henry D. was a 19-year-old friend of his who lived in Roxy, Mississippi, and worked at a lumber mill in Roxy. And they were picked up by the Klan on May 2nd, 1964, beaten in the woods, and then taken across the bridge to Louisiana and dumped into the Mississippi River, attached to some heavy weights while still alive.
It's a terrible story. It was known that the KKK was responsible for their brutal beating and drowning, and yet the FBI didn't do much until you and Thomas Moore pursued the case.
Well, the FBI did undertake an investigation largely within the context of the Mississippi burning case. They first thought that Charles and Henry's remains were those of either Schwerner, Cheney, or Goodman, who were these three civil rights workers who were murdered on June 21st, 1964. They did an investigation. There wasn't James Ford Seal and Charles Edwards, two of the Klansmen involved in the murders, were arrested at the time in November of 1964, but nothing happened. You're right. And then the case kind of languished for many, many years until other journalists tried to pick it up. ABC, Jerry Mitchell down in Mississippi looked at it, and just nothing happened. They weren't able to make a connection between where the murders happened and federal jurisdiction. And then Thomas Moore and I connected in 2005, and just the right timing, right place, I guess, some luck. We got together and worked for 3 years uncovering information, talking to the U.S. attorney down there, whose name was Dunn Lampton. And eventually James Seal was indicted and put in jail.
They actually used the evidence you gave them. They used your documentary. Didn't they play it for the jury?
Yeah, the Mississippi Cold Case was played. Part of it was played for the jury. Actually, there's a part where Thomas Moore and I go to a church to visit one of the Klansmen involved in the murders. And Thomas confronts him there at the church. And the jury watched that part. The part that we heard at the beginning of the program here, where John Draney says the wrong body, was also played at the very beginning of the trial by the prosecution.
And what does it tell you about the American justice system?
Well, I mean, these cases are tough. Old cases are tough to tackle anyways. The Department of Justice, I think, has tried over the years various initiatives to look into civil rights era cold cases and, you know, worked with the FBI to reinvestigate things. But I'm not sure that the funding is always in the right place, and I'm not sure that the effort is actually put forward in the right way. It's a huge system. There's very few reporters working on this beat, and often family members give up. Family members are required in the American system to pressure, I would say, more so than in the Canadian system, and sometimes families just give up without a facilitation of, you know, media or things like that.
So you're coming back to this case in SKS. Why did you want to do that?
It's been, I guess, 13 years since I met Thomas Moore, and in those 13 years, I've gathered, I would say, over 500 hours of material, video, and lots of documents and photographs. So,
what, we got a big drawer somewhere with all this stuff
well,
in
it? Yeah, what's called my bedroom, basically. So I'm surrounded by boxes of my previous cases, and in most cases I've saved things, sometimes I haven't. But for sure, in the Mississippi case, I record my process when I do anything, and it was tailor-made for a podcast. So we can't put everything into the podcast because we have to tell a story at the same time, and it's not just an encyclopedia put online or something, but it's 6 hours versus the 42 minutes that went out in video on television. So
what kinds of things are we going to hear, David?
Oh, we hear backroom negotiations with the Department of Justice officials. We hear conversations with FBI. We hear Thomas Moore going through and Thelma Collins, Henry D's sister, ruminating about how to go forward in the case and look at information that they've never dreamed that they would ever look at again or in their futures. There's actually some revelations, some news that comes out of this from back at the time, which I don't want to spoil. And we have taken some things and put them online as extras that are news, I would say, news making from the time.
So much ends up on the cutting room floor when you're doing a documentary in film. So you've got all of this stuff that gives us more insights into how this stuff unfolded and what people were thinking.
That's right. I mean, there's a huge amount of depth added to the characters and sort of, I guess, the plot, as it were, of the case. And as we said at the beginning of the show, there's a resonance today, I would say, with white supremacy. I mean, latent white supremacy is everywhere. I think there's a lot of talk of white supremacy being enabled because of, you know, what's going on in the States right now. But really, I mean, it can only be enabled because it's already there. And I think, you know, that we're fooling ourselves if we think suddenly white supremacy is a new thing, or, you know, we have the Indian Act that needs to be destroyed in Canada. And I know of at least two places in Ontario where there's a prominent citizen in the town with a Confederate flag waving on the front lawn. So, and that's been going on for years. So we're not talking about something new.
This is very relevant, what happened then and connecting the dots to what we see now. How's Thomas Moore, Charles's brother? How's he doing?
Thomas is great. I talk to him quite frequently. I used to talk to him every day, obviously, back in the day. I spoke to him yesterday. Obviously, he would be able to tell you how he's doing, but from what I can tell, he's great. He, you know, went through life feeling guilty that he'd never been able to help his brother, was away from home at the time when his brother was murdered, and always struggled with that guilt and kind of grew up pushing people away from him. He had a sort of a negative force around him, he would describe. But now Thomas is much lighter. I would describe him as kind of a transformed person. He's a religious person, very religious, I'd say, since this has all happened. And I think that has helped him as well. I think that Moses sent me, or somebody sent me, one of those guys sent me to help him. But he's great. I love talking to him.
Well, we'll hear more from him, too. I really look forward to this. We'll hear more about the actual issues, also get some insights into how you investigate this stuff. So thank you.
Thank you.
David Ridgeon, host of Someone Knows Something. The third season of SKS is available today. cbc.ca/SKS.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenseless.
When President Trump stood in front of America and told us that the person who was responsible for killing 26 people and himself in a Texas church over the weekend was a person with mental problems, and this country didn't have a gun problem, many cringed, for various reasons. One being that the two things aren't necessarily related, but I digress. Today it's been widely reported that Devin Kelly escaped from a mental institution in 2012, which lends credence to one part of Trump's theory. Kelly had also carried out death threats, which those authorities were aware of. Let us not forget that Kelly was also convicted of a domestic violence charge at one point. So, while yes, the killer had mental issues, it didn't change the fact that his ability to get a weapon wasn't held up by anything. That is concerning. Today's election day across America, including right here in Virginia. If any of this stuff resonated with you, you had a chance to make a difference. I'm Clinton Yates, and that's my take.
We begin today's show with Sunday's mass shooting at the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, a tiny rural community east of San Antonio, Texas. Just after 11 a.m. on Sunday, a man walked into the church wearing a ballistic vest and carrying a Ruger AR-556 assault-style rifle and opened fire, first outside, then went back to his truck, went back into the church and killed 26 people, wounding at least 20 more. Among the victims was a pregnant woman, the 14-year-old daughter of the church's pastor, other children as young as 5 years old. The suspected shooter has been identified as a 26-year-old white man named Devin Patrick Kelly from New Braunfels, Texas. Kelly enlisted in the U.S. Air Force in 2010. In 2012, he was court-martialed for assaulting his wife and child, leading to a year imprisonment and a bad conduct discharge in 2014. The bad conduct discharge versus a dishonorable discharge meant Kelly was still eligible to buy firearms legally. In 2014, Kelly was also charged with mistreatment, neglect, or cruelty to animals in Colorado, though the case was ultimately dismissed. In April 2016, Kelly purchased the Ruger AR-556 rifle at an Academy Sports and Outdoor store in San Antonio, Texas. In filling out the background check paperwork, Kelly indicated he did not have a criminal history that disqualified him from purchasing the firearm. On Sunday, Kelly was found dead in his car from a gunshot wound shortly after the shooting, about 11 miles away. It's not yet known whether he killed himself or whether he was shot by a local resident who opened fire on Kelly after the church massacre, then chased him along with another resident to that 11 miles away. Late on Sunday night, Sutherland Springs residents gathered for a candlelight vigil to mourn the victims of the attack.
It's very devastating, and it's hard to hear the people you know were hurt that bad, and they just died.
That's why I'm here.
Children you knew.
Yes, children that my, and Jenny, she worked in the nursery. She's like the only person outside of my family that I trusted with my kids while we were at church. It's just really hard to hear stuff happen to people that you know.
Our guests are in Austin, Texas, Ed Scruggs, vice chair and spokesperson for Texas Gun Sense. In Philadelphia, we're joined by George Ticarella Marr, political science professor at Drexel University, who was banned from campus after questioning why mass shootings in the U.S. are almost always carried out by white men. But I wanted to bring George Ticarella Marr into this conversation of Drexel University. You wrote immediately after the Las Vegas massacre, where the 64-year-old white man named Paddock had opened fire on concertgoers below, killing 59 of them. You were banned from the Drexel campus after questioning why mass shootings in the United States are almost always carried out by white men. Is that right?
Yes. And to be clear, when I began to write about what had happened in Las Vegas, I was really writing about this broad question, right? And I think this is a question that we all need to grapple with. When you see these cases of sort of mass, just shocking mass brutality, what is it that makes white men so prone to this kind of behavior? And what might be going on today in our country, in which people are stoking a sort of victim complex among white men? What might be happening today to encourage this kind of behavior and to radicalize these kind of actions? kids. And I was immediately subject to a torrent of sort of abuse and threats from, you know, right-wing media outlets. And, you know, we're talking about Breitbart, The Daily Caller, and these kind of websites. And it was on the basis of those and the purported threats that they represented that I was excluded from campus. My classes were initially canceled, despite the fact that in my classes we'd had conversations about this, despite the fact that my students are very knowledgeable and intuitively grasp what is going on in the world around them and were open to having conversations about these difficult things.
So your response to what happened on Sunday?
I mean, I think we're seeing this, these kind of atrocities occurring, and we need to be really asking not only what can we do. I think these are important questions. What kind of immediate institutional reforms, whether it's targeted, you know, targeted gun control for domestic violence, you know, might be effective. But we also can't lose sight of these broader questions and ask what is going on in our society today. What is happening with regard to not only white people, but white men in particular? What is going on with regard to race and gender as they function together? And in this case in particular, again, we don't know all the facts. We don't know all the details. But we're talking about institutions that also serve as breeding grounds for violent behavior. We're talking about not only sexual assault in the military, but domestic abuse of those surrounding it and those outside of it. And we're talking about other institutions as well that you could bring into the picture, institutions like policing, in which domestic violence is absolutely rife and in which it's very difficult to keep weapons out of the hands of those domestic abusers. And so we need to think very deeply, I think, about the structural role of what's going on in the society. Trump is abroad selling weapons, and we've got someone who, in this case, apparently was trained to engage in violence abroad. And yet we act surprised when these people have breaks, when they, you know, fall into some kind of crisis, when they find maybe feelings of entitlement, frustrated, that they then resort to violence. You know, when we're talking about a structure and institutional apparatus that trains people in violence and that encourages them to feel as though they're on the losing side of history. Trump makes hay out of the fact that, that white men in particular feel as though they're the victims of this society despite being in absolute control of it. And this is something that is powerfully dangerous, and it's why we're seeing not only the rise in violent attacks more generally and the rise of far-right movements, but we're certainly seeing, clearly sort of some very serious incidents of mass violence as well.
You know, what's interesting, yesterday, for hour, after this horror on television, you know, it came out that there was this mass killing in Texas, and they said the worst church massacre in U.S. history, and they said the worst Texas massacre. No one was saying anything about the killer hour after hour, but clearly people had seen him, right? Some had survived, people outside, the police, he was dead, whether it was self-inflicted or someone shot him. They clearly knew. And they were talking about, one, the tragedy, and two, not saying anything. And it only led us to believe it must be a white man who did this, because we would have known, I think, right away if the person was a person of color or certainly Muslim. We know that often before when it's a case where someone is a Muslim or person of color, that's what they say immediately. Now it was just left hanging. And so you knew that this would be the case.
That's absolutely the case, I think. Whiteness is never seen as a cause in and of itself of these kinds of massacres, of, you know, other forms of violence, despite the fact that whiteness is a structure of privilege and it's a structure of power, and a structure that when it feels threatened, lashes out. And so that's the kind of thing that we really need to think about. Not only why is it, and I think there's a lot of attention to the fact that we demonize often Muslims or other people of color when these attacks occur. The far right, of course, jumps on any violence by people of color, and yet, doesn't want to talk about the real deep structures of white supremacy in our society. And again, not just the fringe, not just the Nazi movements, but what people are going through every day and what it is that is driving people to these kinds of situations where they feel so entitled to dominance that when that's questioned, they can explode in these very, very unpredictable ways. And on targets that, are not, it's not a question of, white supremacy playing a role simply because someone is targeting people of color. We're talking about people who are having, clear mental issues. But again, the cause needs to be identified outside and beyond that. And we need to think much, much harder about what's going on in our society that makes it so sick.
And very clearly, to clarify, so what is your status now at Drexel? And explain how other people have been treated in other situations. You cannot go on campus?
Yes, that is the status at this point. I'm currently teaching classes online. My students are protesting and mobilizing to have me return to campus because there's no reason, certainly, to exclude faculty from campus for having important public conversations and for teaching about hard questions. That's what we're there to do. But what you're seeing is a broad wave of aggression against faculty. You've seen dozens of cases, whether it's, you know, Tommy Curry at Texas A&M, Kiangi Amata Taylor at Princeton, Johnny Eric Williams at Trinity College. You're seeing far-right websites creating stoking outrage, attacking faculty members who dare to speak about white supremacy and racism. That's really the common thread of all these cases, is these are anti-racist faculty members, usually people of color, who are targeted, who are attacked, who are threatened, and really having their lives threatened over being willing to talk about what's going on in the country today.
Terrorism means that your physical being is at risk by fanatic factions that want things that frequently are unreasonable, or when we talk about terrorism.
Oh, wait a minute. I just want to make sure, because definitions are very important. I just want to make sure I got your definition. You said terrorism is when you believe your physical being is at risk because of fanatics and what they might be willing to do to you. Is that an accurate paraphrase of what you said?
Pretty much.
Okay, so let's apply that, because I said Gray Perez was practicing terror, because you said I was incorrect. I just want to get this response, and then you continue. So based on your definition, this white woman, Gray Perez, yelling at a non-white parent, "Get out of my office, you nigger, get out," that's not an act of terrorism. That wouldn't lead you to any reason to think, whoa, my physical being might be in harm's way because of this fanatic yelling at me, calling me a nigger, and telling me to get out. That's not terrorism by your definition?
No, it is not.
The weekend, someone defaced a woman's garage in Brookings, and they used a racial slur.
Yeah, Stephanie Ari says it is the second time something like this has happened this year, and she wants to get her story out.
KSFY News reporter Kelly Smith sat down with her earlier today and has more tonight about how her family is dealing with what happened. It is our 10 o'clock top story, Kelly.
Brian Courtney, Ari has been surrounded with love and support from the Brookings community. And the reason she thinks it's so important to share her story is to show people what the small town is really like.
It just doesn't make any sense to me.
For the second time this year, Stephanie Ari is cleaning up racist graffiti from her garage. And while she is surprised by what happened, she refuses to let it get her down.
Feeling something gives whoever did this power. And I am sure as shooting not going to give somebody my power.
And the community is refusing to let her go through this alone. Close friends have stuck by her side through this ordeal.
There's nothing like a wrestling community. They come together, and they come together strong. And it's no different than the Brookings community.
People are also showing support online. Ari posted the picture on Facebook, and it has been shared hundreds of times.
How that blew up is just a testament to the people in this community and how they did what I asked. I asked him to share, and I didn't have to say anything more than that.
It's why she wanted to share her story with the media.
You have a community that can't comprehend this either. They don't understand why it's happening to them, and that's kind of the reason why I felt compelled that this time I needed to speak, because this isn't indicative of Brookings.
Ari is working with the Brookings Police Department.
Brookings Police Department has been phenomenal. They have just been very quick to get over there to take a look at it. Officer Lee is, he's amazing.
And while she thinks the person who did this should answer for it,
I believe somebody should have to look at my 9-year-old and my 13-year-old and tell them why.
She bears no ill will toward them.
I hope you find help, because anybody that does that has to be lacking, whether it's spiritually, whether it's emotionally, or whether it's mentally.
Ari says she has heard that there may be people setting up a GoFundMe account for her. She did not have anything to do with that effort, and she is asking people to not donate money to it. She says if someone feels the need to donate to a cause, to donate to the police department that is working on this case, or to a local charity. Brian.
Kelly Smith, thank you. We reached out to the Brookings Police Department for comment on this case, but they declined this evening because they say they are still investigating exactly what happened.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on black Americans from colonial times to the present.
Roughly a third of Latinos in America report they've experienced discrimination in their daily lives. According to a poll recently released by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. That number is important as scientists begin to learn more about how racism affects people's health and their longevity. Reporter Ray Ellen Bichel has this next story in our series, You, Me, and Them.
The day Dr. Roberto Montenegro finished his PhD was memorable, but not for the right reasons.
I still cringe when I think about it.
His colleagues at UCLA had taken him and his wife out to a fancy restaurant. They were celebrating his new PhD in sociology, and he was about to head to medical school. He was legit.
We laughed and we ate and we were excited we didn't have to pay for this.
But when they got in line for the valet, a really nice car pulled up to the curb. A woman got out and walked past the other couples in line, Montenegro says, and...
She gets to me and she hands me her keys.
She assumed he was a valet.
I vividly remember turning red, and I don't often turn red, and I remember my heart pounding. I remember feeling really confused and hurt and angry.
5 minutes later, still waiting for his car, it happened again.
And even now, reliving that story, it's uncomfortable.
This was not the first or the last time he'd encounter racism. At conferences, colleagues would accidentally try to order drinks from him. As a medical student, people at the hospital would sometimes mistake him for a technician or a janitor, even when he was wearing his white doctor's coat.
That happens to me so much.
Montenegro's experiences might not sound like a big deal, but a group of researchers thinks that being discriminated against over and over again could actually hurt a person's health.
When you start to worry about something, whether that's race or something else, then that initiates a biological stress response.
That's Amani Nuru-Jeter, a social epidemiologist at the University of California, Berkeley. She and Dr. Montenegro, who's now a fellow in child psychiatry at Seattle Children's Hospital, are trying to understand what discrimination can actually do to your body. That night people assume Montenegro was a valet.
Turning red and my heart pounding.
Those are signs his body was stressed, cranking up the levels of hormones like adrenaline and cortisol. Those hormones can be really helpful for gearing up to fight or to flee, but it's not good if they linger.
For example, one of the things we're finding in my research is that this process of racism stress is associated with kind of chronic low-grade inflammation.
And that, says Nuru-Jeter, could put someone at a higher risk for something like heart disease. Other studies have found associations between racist experiences and things like sleep problems or even asthma. Researchers like Nuru-Jeter hypothesize that the stress of repeatedly being singled out as the other can be biologically damaging and might be responsible, in part, for health disparities in America, like the gap in life expectancy between Black and white Americans.
Prolonged elevation, circulation of these stress hormones in our bodies can be very toxic and compromise our body's ability to regulate key biological systems. So it just gets us really out of whack and leaves us susceptible to a bunch of poor health outcomes.
Now, this kind of research is really complicated. There's no thermometer for racism, and it's not like scientists can take a group of people, expose them to discrimination, and then see how they do compared to everyone else. So researchers find associations, not causations. But sometimes they get a slightly sharper glimpse of how discrimination and poor health might be related. Like on May 12, 2008, when, as the AP reported, a small army descended onto a town in Iowa.
Federal agents raided this meatpacking plant in Iowa on Monday after
900 agents with Immigration and Customs Enforcement raided a meat processing plant. They were looking for people who were working illegally in the U.S. They reportedly handcuffed almost everyone who looked Latino and ended up arresting more than a tenth of the town's population, charging many of them with felonies for knowingly working under false social security numbers, even though few were reportedly guilty of that crime.
In all, more than 300 people were loaded onto buses and taken away.
Arlene T. Geronimus, a behavioral scientist at the University of Michigan, has studied the episode.
The news of this raid and pictures were pretty frightening because there were these helicopters and it was such a military zone. And then they had, you know, handcuffing all the employees who were assumed to be Latino.
It was an extremely stressful event for the people who got arrested and their families. But the event appears to have had a ripple effect throughout the state. As Geronimus and her colleagues wrote this year in the International Journal of Epidemiology, after the raid, Latino women living in Iowa started giving birth to smaller babies.
Pregnant women of Latino descent throughout the state of Iowa experienced on average about a 24% greater risk of their babies being born low birth weight than they had in that very same period of time the previous year.
Babies born small are at higher risk of dying in infancy and of having health problems later on. Before the raid, Latino women in Iowa didn't have a higher risk of low birth weight than white women did.
But there is a spike that happens to be exactly when the raid was.
A spike in that rate that even affected babies born to Latina moms who were U.S. citizens, people who shouldn't have been worried about being arrested or deported.
The trends are so stark.
Other researchers have noticed a connection between experiencing stressful events like natural disasters and babies being born preterm or low birth weight. Geronimus thinks in this case, it has something to do with the stress of racism. And if that's true, it means the stress of discrimination can set the stage for health problems before a person has even entered the world. For NPR News, I'm Raelynn Bischel.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, November 11th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, counter-racist suggestions, observations you would like to share. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Couple things before we get started. First of all, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported nearly a decade of counter-racist programming. I hope the context of white supremacy has helped listeners get an accurate understanding of what white supremacy racism is and how it works. You can also support us by visiting my wish list at Amazon.com. It is under Gus T. Renegade. It's also linked at my blog. Thanks to all the folks who have been gracious enough to nab items from the wish list. Hope the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Other things I wanted to make sure to touch on before we get started, or before I get to the callers. The situation with LiAngelo Ball. He is the basketball player at UCLA. He is the one of the children of LeVar Ball. His brother is in the NBA right now. He plays for the Los Angeles Lakers. But LiAngelo Ball, he was arrested in China. It's been reported, talked about quite a bit this week. He and two other teammates, who both appear to be black males to me, they were arrested for stealing sunglasses. When what I've heard about this incident, number one, one of our listeners, Emmy, she said that she did hear a report on the radio. I just wasn't able to get the report to verify. If other people heard details around this, that would be great to share. But she reported that she heard on the radio that when this incident happened, there were white players on the UCLA team that were excused from this, I guess, investigation. They were allowed to leave. And then the other three players, all black, including LiAngelo Ball, they were arrested and charged, and it became a big deal. As I said, I haven't been able to confirm that, but if other folks saw or heard anything about that, that would be great to share. The thought that came to my mind in all of this is this seems like another illustration of the term Schadenfreude that we've talked about on the program before. This is a German term that means taking pleasure in seeing someone else suffer or fail or have some sort of harm happen to them. it's just been my impression that a lot of white people have been joyous, gleeful in seeing the son of LeVar Ball have these problems or be accused of stealing, and how is this going to mess up his basketball career and just all of this. And if folks remember, LeVar Ball, he's the one that had his own shoe brand. And I think he was selling the shoes for like $400 or something. And he wasn't going through Nike. He started his own apparel company for his children. He's got all these basketball prodigies, kind of similar to Richard Williams, and training them to be great at basketball. But it just seemed to me that a lot of white people really, really gloated and enjoyed seeing this happen over the past week or so. Maybe I'm in error. Continuing, the report that was on the Young Turks about Mariah Carey and the allegations where she's being sued by a former employee who says that she used to come in, I guess, in these negligees. And he found it uncomfortable and views that as some sort of sexual harassment. And then also the accusations that she was racist. Like, whoa. When I went to investigate that report, I was listening to hear what are these allegations going to be against Mariah Carey about sexual misconduct, because that was the lead. It didn't say anything about racism. Then you get, you know, a minute or two into the clip and now she's being accused of being a racist. Like, oh, man, I said it. And this was another one in context. That's the Young Turks. We've heard a lot of their clips over the years. Again, I think it's very important in analyzing their material, because these are thought of as good white people. For starters, having any individual classified as white even hint, even raise the question, do you think Mariah Carey could be practicing racism? What if she says, you know, I think white people are beneath me and I just despise white people, as though she's practicing black supremacy or biracial supremacy or whatever it is, racially ambiguous people supremacy. Any white person saying that, they don't get the benefit of the doubt. If you're white, you cannot be ignorant about white supremacy racism. You know that Mariah Carey is not practicing racism against any non-white person. You know that is foolishness. You're wasting time, and it is a distraction from authentic problems that are happening for you to be sitting up and talking about something that's totally nonsense. And whites do this all the time. It injects so much confusion. We talked about this yesterday in Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk. This is how you end up having so much confusion about the term racism. It gets inflated. That was the term Mr. Postman used. When everybody starts being accused of being a racist, O.J. Simpson is a racist. Mariah Carey is a racist. Now, it's confusion, and the people who end up being confused, non-white people, black people. Also with all of this, because George Takei, I think it's Takei, George Takei. He was in non-white male, so-called Asian. He was in Star Trek. He's been in a lot of other TV film over the years. He's older now. I think he identifies openly as a gay male. He's been accused of sexually molesting another male earlier in his career. I think the accusation or the accuser said that this happened in the 80s. The first thing that came to mind was, number one, I think with many different times where a white person is charged with a crime, a lot of times people have said that they see a pattern of to distract, to take attention away from white people being criminals, whatever it is, child rapists or killers, shooters, whatever it is, sexual predators. There will be immediately attention towards a black person doing the same thing. Or a non-white person doing the same thing. So it's, oh, this is not something, this is not a white problem. Everybody, you know, participates in these sort of crimes. I think right at the same time or near the same time period when there was a lot of attention and focus on Jerry Sandusky, child predator, child rapist, a lot of attention also went towards the black male that worked on Sesame Street that did Elmo, similar allegations. I think people have pointed that pattern out. I would say I suspect that could happen with these sexual allegations because most of the people that have been accused before Mr. Cosby, but most of the people that have been accused over the last year or so have been white, especially white males. It would not surprise me if it begins to broaden, where now you start seeing black people being accused, just something that I would pay attention to, especially with now Mariah Carey and George Takei being accused. The other thing with George Takei, I remembered when he labeled Clarence Thomas a clown in blackface and called him a black buffoon because Clarence Thomas gave a dissenting opinion on the gay rights when gay marriage came before the Supreme Court in 2015, which did pass. The Supreme Court approved gay rights. They called it one of the biggest civil rights victories of all time. And Clarence Thomas was on the, the minority side, quote unquote, minority opinion. And he wrote one of the dissenting opinions, but George Takei really went after him in a very racial way, focusing on him being black in his attacks of Mr. Thomas. And he didn't by name castigate any of the other justices who wrote dissenting opinions or cast dissenting opinions. Next, the situation with Devin Kelly. He's the white male shooter who was accused of killing 26 people down in Texas this week. I thought it was extremely important where they were saying that when he was 18, he was, quote unquote, dating a 13-year-old. That is another one, incorrect use of terms. That's something we focus on in this book, focus on this broadcast consistently. That's not dating. That is rape. That's not even statutory. That's just rape, period. It's no discussion. And they just try and slip that by you. Child rape. Just try and slip that by you on a regular basis with incorrect use of terms. And that was widespread this week where I didn't see people referring to that as this person also had a pattern of being a sexual predator and raping children. I didn't see anything even close to that. It was dating as though they were in some sort of, you know, cool little high school romance. Well, that's not the case at all. I guess if you need to think about it, 18, that would be like a high school senior, quote unquote, dating someone in the eighth grade, people in the States. If, you know, you want to think about it, if you think, hey, that's no big deal there. That's not a problem. And if you want to think about it, if this had been a black person, a black male, Michael Brown Jr., perhaps, dating a 13-year-old. Do you think they would have used the term dating? Also, when they talked about Devin Kelly, I thought that they emphasized the reports that I read, heard, saw over the week. I thought that they placed greater emphasis on the fact that he was wearing all black for this attack than the fact that he was classified as white. The lead that I saw in the New York Times was not another white man commits mass murder. It was dressed in all black. Just in my view, I think that's consistent because I've also seen that be a pattern at the beginning of the year when Donald Trump was being inaugurated. It was the same thing. They had protesters, but in black. That became emphasized in black, wearing all black. Protesters running around the nation's capital, throwing paint and dumping over trash cans. It just, in my view, that's another way of associating, keep maintaining that connection. Even when it's white people committing the crimes, you're still associating blackness, black people with criminality, violence, people that should be caged and locked up, killed, maybe even. Next up, one of our listeners, I talked about her situation before. She is a teenager, high school senior, and she wrote us before she was having a problem with a teacher. She had a non-white, non-black instructor. He had been accused previously of sexual misconduct. It was, I guess, not founded. He was allowed to continue teaching, even though these allegations were levied. Our student listener, she said that this instructor had made racist comments about black people. He had explained it away by saying that he was 12% black. She said that he had contacted her when she was in a different class. She was in gym and she takes his government class. And he came to contact her while she was in gym to ask her just strange questions about, you know, his class and how he should operate things. She had a pattern of just troublesome, incorrect behavior from this instructor. And she wanted to know what should be done. And we gave some suggestions. Listeners did as well about how to handle it, talking to her parents and trying to get moved out of this class, documenting, getting the other students to document. She wrote in and gave us an update. So she says She didn't get to hear all of our suggestions from the broadcast, but she did get to hear a number of them. She said, I appreciate all of the advice. Right now, it's too late for me to switch classes in the fall, but I could have the opportunity in the spring. I have been documenting his comments so that I can explain why I want to transfer out later on. He has not made any direct comments to me lately. I now realize he may have been trying to be inappropriate with me, and since I have stopped engaging with him, he has lowered my grade. I am upset about this, but I refuse to confront him because of how inappropriate he is. My mother knows about the situation, great, and she suggested that I focus on my other subjects and stay away from this teacher. Lately, he's been harassing a student that is clearly special needs. This student is Guyanese of Indian descent. He encourages the student to act out and tells him to do push-ups, take off his shirt, or comment on female students. He asks him who he finds attractive. When a student asked why he didn't tell the boy to stop, he said, if you had a funny show on television, why would you change the channel? He is the purest form of entertainment, all in quotes. He always smiles when the student has an outburst and really seems to enjoy it. This teacher is disgusting and he belongs anywhere but in the classroom. That's pretty much all that has been going on. Not much has changed, but I wanted to update you all and thank you all for the advice. I'm super glad that she's been speaking to her mom about this. I think we had all said that before, and making sure that she keeps her informed about what's happening in the classroom. And, you know, if they have any sort of conferences or what have you, I would definitely raise concerns if she goes to the school, you know, about this situation. And even the grade thing, I think that's important, because if you're doing the work, you're a senior, you have aspirations, you know, to do great things with your life. Just my opinion, I think that has to be a part of our counter-racist strategy as scholars, students. It's been my experience that white professors, teachers at all levels, many of them will not grade, or they will practice racism, white supremacy as they grade, meaning that if you are a black person, you might experience instances of errors on your test, errors in grading, particularly anything that is subjective. When it's something where you got to write an essay and what have you, oh man, that allows for a lot of racist discretion. And I think that as students, I think it's very important to challenge, or I won't even use the word challenge, but to learn how to use words to get the grade that you earned. Because a lot of times instructors, racist instructors, they will count on us not asking questions, not coming to see them to see, you know, why did I get this grade? Can we, you know, maybe look at this? I think maybe I earned something higher than the score that I got. I think that's extremely important. And I know in this situation, it can be tough because this guy's been doing all kinds of inappropriate behavior. But I do think that's important for us to think about, and a skill that we need to hone, because this sort of thing will be a pattern of behavior as long as you're in school, where you have a white instructor, where it could be a myriad of things, but somehow it ends up being them saying, I'm not going to grade this person correctly. And I think it's something that you have to be very precise about. Important use of words, keeping your cool, not getting angry, and recognizing what Emmy shared with us previously, that this white person does have a lot of control over transcripts, your GPA, grades, all of that. Extremely true. But I have seen where you can effectively just calmly, same thing that we talk about here in workplace racism, calmly asking questions, you take notes, you use the syllabus, which is kind of the policy and procedure for the classroom, and you can be very effective at defending your grade and even sometimes getting your grade increased, where they'll acknowledge that, hey, maybe there has been an error, maybe I have been doing something incorrect here. With that, if folks have any suggestions for our young scholar, that would be great. I'm sure she would appreciate it. The number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share whatever thoughts, observations you have, that way everybody will have an opportunity to speak. If you have additional comments or questions, just make sure everyone gets at least one chance to speak, and then you can, you know, share any additional comments. If you could please use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just if you know you're in an environment where it's noisy, people are talking, or maybe you have, you know, other noise and what have you happening around you, just use your mute button. That way you can share whatever you like and then mute so that other people can have the same quiet and it doesn't disrupt the quality of the broadcast. For this broadcast exclusively, if we could not use metaphors, I would super appreciate it. It's been my experience that frequently racists, they will use metaphors to spread confusion. They will make comparisons, analogies between two separate entities that are not equivalent. They will do this on a regular basis and with great conviction. Victims of racism, white supremacy, we have been confused. We've been exposed to this racist, deceptive behavior for a long time. And then many of us, we are still learning. Sometimes when we have not quite come to a conclusion, we're still thinking, trying to come to a conclusion. We might use a metaphor to hopefully convey our not completely formed thoughts. And often this can create a lot of confusion. If we could just be explicit, direct about what it is that we would like to say, I would super appreciate it. I will prompt about the metaphors. Sometimes we just need to take more time to think about what it is that we want to say, and that is allowed. No problem there. With that, we will go ahead and get to the first few folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed.
All right, can I be heard?
Greetings, Puff.
Hello. Just want to make a quick, couple of quick comments about, speaking of white patterns, you just talked about white patterns. I noticed a white pattern as far as covering both sides of the argument. Like when things happen, like this lady that was in the, I think the, what is that called? The stuff before the show starts. The lady that got spray painted nigger in her neighborhood or whatever. Anyway, she had a racist incident, and in other words, it was the police investigating or whatever. But I noticed that they covered both sides of the argument. Like whenever white people notice that you've been wronged by racist incidents, what they do is they come about and kind of quote-unquote rally on your side or whatever. And it's like you get both sides. Are you for black people, against black people, or whatever? And I noticed that pattern, that they cover both sides of the argument. And that thing about the last little part about the police, she going to donate some more money to the police, or whatever, behind that incident, that just added further insult to injury because, you know, with the police department, I mean, they receive enough grants and all of that, and they're publicly funded. So, you know, that's in the budget of any city. And then plus they get state grants, and why do they need more funding? I don't know. And I have a question for everybody on the line. Don't you notice in your city that the police are trying to take up money all the time? They have the lights and some kind of police fund. Like, what is that? I mean, nobody knows. It's just crazy. With all the stuff happening and all this type of stuff, you know, with the shootings of Eric Garner and all these people that are, you know, being totally brutalized by the police, it's just very disheartening. And I'll mute my line.
I did think that was a great point about the pattern. If a non-white person, black person, is mistreated, abused in some way, that you will have whites who enter and say, hey, I'm not a racist. And it's so sad that this happened. I do think that that is critical because it really emphasizes, or I think the reason that that's so important is make sure non-white people don't think that all white people are racist. It's very important to think that, hey, there are some good, not racist whites, and we're here to help and, you know, knit you a sweater. We'll even help you scrape nigger off your garage. I think that's critical and a big time pattern. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, caller, retired firefighter.
Greetings, everyone. As we are speaking, there is a high-profile college football game that's on television, University of Miami versus Notre Dame. I think back in 1988, there was a white male who was selling T-shirts. I think he may have been a college student at Notre Dame, selling T-shirts stating convicts versus Catholics, or maybe been the other way around. I don't think the order of things was count, but basically through racist codification, you can basically see that Catholics represent white people and convicts represent non-white black people. If you didn't know, University of Miami at one time was not really that good of a football team for a long period of time. And in and around the about mid to late 80s, it started recruiting a whole lot of black males on their team, and they all of a sudden started becoming very, very good. And what goes along with the meaning of being a black male also dominated the football program at the University of Miami. And they became very good to whereas Notre Dame traditionally didn't have a whole lot of black males on the team. And they were still kind of good, but as most of these Division I colleges started figuring out, is that the more that you recruit black males, the better you would become as far as the team. And it's not so much about they care anything about black males. It's, they care about winning, and also along with winning, there's a lot of money for the institution and also the coaches and coaching staff and basically other people involved with athletics. So that's the name of the basically of the things that are going on in college sports today. Just wanted to mention that as far as that concern. Also with the student, the college student, parent teacher conference. As far as that grade situation, parent teacher conference. Anything that goes on in that classroom, that particular child sees is not going well, of course they should, as we suggested before, should inform the parent. And from there, the parent should be entitled to, any time he or she wants, is to have a teacher-parent conference, and also maybe a supervised one with a assistant principal or a principal in that room at the time to speak about anything that that child is confronted with in that classroom, whether he or she, I think, I don't know if it's he or she that you were talking about, but whether or not that child is a grade situation or the behavior of the teacher or whatever it is, And that would perhaps put pressure on that teacher to at least be wary of that student because they have some sort of structural backing behind them. And that's it. Thank you.
Great suggestions, retired firefighter. The Catholics versus convicts game, they have a documentary that's just about that shirt, ESPN's 30 for 30. So I mentioned before, most of those documentaries deal with racism somehow, some way. Some of them are more directly about racism than others. And that one is real direct about racism, where even some of the white people who made that shirt acknowledged, yeah, that was kind of racist what we did. And they still refer to when these teams play, that's still the hashtag that they use. I've never been a college football fan, but that they were these teams playing today, they've been talking about it for a while. As retired firefighter said, that's been a big profile game, but I just saw the hashtag and had no idea what it was, and then did some digging, and of course everything is about racism, white supremacy in some way, shape, form. And with the suggestion for the black female high school student, a great suggestion about parent-teacher conference. I understand for some parents it might be difficult if you have a work schedule or just you have a lot of things to do as a victim of racism in your, you know, daily activities. But if you can schedule time to actually go to the class, and particularly in a case like this where there are a lot of problems and he's doing a lot of incorrect things, that might be a big help if you can just go observe. I think most schools would welcome a parent wanting to come and just be in class and be a presence, showing a parent who is engaged with their child's education. I think most schools that would not be a problem. You maybe sign in and, you know, let them know that you're there. You get a visitor pass and go to the classroom. If that could happen, and particularly since I think she said she only has, maybe she might be able to switch classes after, I think they have semesters. So if it's a limited amount of time, maybe you have 2 months or so, 2-3 months left in with this instructor, I would definitely try to see if your mom could come in and just observe for one period, speak to him, parent-teacher conference. I think that could be very helpful for hopefully the final 2-3 months that you have to be in this guy's class. Other folks we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, *61, if you have commentary you want to share.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, thank you for taking my call, and hello to everyone. This is Red in Nevada, and I first wanted to start off with some notes about the segments. The first thing, of course, was the segment where the person, the interviewer, was speaking to the doctor about the opioid epidemic, and the main thing that stuck out to me was that how the doctor, he had gave three excuses as to why Black people or Black and Latinos, and I'm not a person who ever uses that type of alliance, especially with me being in Nevada, being back in Nevada, I see how Black people are treated by quote unquote Latinos. Anyways, but the first of the two excuses that he gave were him, he was definitely practicing racism, where he, and also he basically ended the comments saying that, oh, well, this could just be some unconscious thing, makes me think about, oh, well, unconscious bias. It was just, I just thought that whole thing was ridiculous. And I've been speaking about for a while now about the opioid epidemic, I mean, it's, whites are not really taking into, or I don't feel like they would ever actually admit the fact that they are the ones who, you know, of course, started this epidemic, and just leave it at that, not saying any and not going into, well, you know, it's making up something else, like making up another excuse or what have you. It's always just somebody else's fault. The other thing that I wanted to point out with this, with the other segment about the two Black males who were found, who were killed by the Klan, I think that was in Mississippi, and the documenter, or I'm sorry, I forgot what he exactly was, but he had used the metaphor when speaking about the victim's brother. He had said he is much lighter now, and I thought that once again that's a white man practicing racism. I think, if I'm not mistaken, he is white. He was practicing racism now that, you know, before this black male, he was very upset. And now, you know, since, you know, they were able to do more for his brother's cold case and actually get it resolved, if I'm not mistaken, then that means that now he's transitioning. And I think he also used the word transition, and he's a lighter person, whiter person. So that's the other thing. And then the last thing that I wanted to comment on about me being in Nevada, being close to Las Vegas, and it kind of goes into the segment about the white people, the white man who shot up the church, and how, you know, guns will never go away. In Nevada, they are still having gun shows. And I actually saw a person holding up a sign saying, you know, advertising guns. So if you can have the worst, quote unquote, at least to white people, the worst mass shooting in history, and you could still have, you know, 2-day gun shows and what have you, big advertisements about guns, there's not going to be a change. And I'm sorry. The last thing was, I spoke about the whole hashtag Vegas Strong slogan. And I've seen now businesses, I actually saw one law firm, a lawyer, he had that hashtag. He has a big billboard, and he has that hashtag almost as if it's a marketing ploy. And also I wanted to say, just listening to the Neil Postman book, I think it was definitely constructive, much more constructive than the Frantz Fanon book. And it helped me to understand better how white people talk and how they are using words to make sure that they are still, everyone is still in that same, white people are still in that same semantic environment of racism, white supremacy. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Red in Nevada. Great observations about the guns still being sold in Nevada. I don't think, if you haven't been to Nevada, like, just I think it's difficult to appreciate, like, if you don't understand what it means to be white, and if you have not been to, like, Las Vegas, like, prostitution is legal, they sell liquor in the grocery store, they have slot machines in the grocery store. I mean, it's like just vice on top of vice on top of vice in that sort of environment, and then the guns and the gambling and everything else. It's just, you know, I'm not surprised at all that, you know, the shooting and everything, like, literally an hour, 24 hours, and it's back to casino. I mean, they got deep fried Twinkies. They brag about having deep fried Twinkies in Las Vegas. It's probably connected to Dr. Welsing's theory in some way as well. We have other folks who had commentary we've not heard from. The folks who have hands up, spectating, listening. They're just hanging out, I reckon. While folks are waiting, I'll make sure to get out the number, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *6. If you would like to participate. And remember, Puff did ask a question about if, I guess, folks, depending on where you happen to be at geographically, about enforcement officers, if they are doing a lot of fundraising in your area. She wanted a response to that as well. And I would appreciate response if anyone did hear or read, see information about the LiAngelo Ball situation, UCLA basketball player that was arrested in China. If people saw any information about whether or not any of the white players on the team were involved or not involved, if that was mentioned in any reports that you heard, I would super appreciate that, because I was trying to find it and I just couldn't find any additional information on that point. Other folks that are listening? Are folks still spectating, or did people who had hands up have commentary they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Roz.
Hey, greetings to you, Gus, and to all the callers and listeners. To answer, was it Puff who asked the question? I'm sorry, I don't want to get the name incorrect.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I have noticed that the police or PAL, and they're out with, like, the buckets on the corners asking for money and all of that kind of stuff. I don't know why they do that stuff. I just think it's just their own form of crowdfunding, and the crowd is the people driving down the street. And if they choose to fund whatever these police are doing, to me, when you give them money, it's just paying them for killing us and abusing us. But yes, I have noticed that. I'm thinking it could be something that they're planning to do nationwide that we're not aware of yet, that could be facilitating it, now that you brought that up. And it's good to kind of find out when these things are happening in more than one place. It might give us insight to some of their machinations as things develop. Now, to jump on these clips, the clip with Cenk Uygur, I can't stand those people, and I put people in quotes, but I can't stand them. The white female, man, did she expose how she is not confused about racism. Just her whole understanding of the fact that non-white people, victims of white supremacy, cannot be racist. She just made it quite plain in how she explained everything, and I thought that that was great. I think that that is the sort of information white people exploit quite often with non-white people when they do things and non-white people react to them, especially if the non-white person may not be as codified and they might not. They might react in a more emotional manner, that white people will exploit the fact that they know that a victim of racism can never practice racism against their oppressor. It's an oxymoron. It's just non-existent. So I think that that's something we should always be aware of, because all white people know this when they deal with us. It's about how we work with them, understanding that they're predatory, they're apex predators. The clip about Mariah Carey practicing racism on her white Italian security guard, I found that quite interesting, because I did read an article about that. And from what I read in the article, she did say she would prefer to have black people around her, but it alluded to the fact that the white security was practicing racism. To me, it looks like it could be where they're turning it against the victim again, in this sense, because from what I read in the article, it seemed to me that the white people around her were practicing racism, and she didn't want white people around her. She wanted black people around her, and they're using that now to add her to the mix of all the other psychopathic sexual deviance that's taking place. The clip on the child that had the genetically modified skin developed to save them, really, it just takes white survival to a whole new level. If they're able to generate new skin for a child who, and this should really let us know, look at the diseases they have. Like, what kind of disease is that, where your skin doesn't form normally and function as one flesh? They're like separated and you're getting bruised and, What is that? And I mean, some of our people would do anything to have children with that. Like, that's crazy to me. Like, just the whole concept of that illness. And it comes from them being inbred. All of these things are spinoffs from them being an inbred race. And if we really understand that, we will stay as far away from them as far as any sort of sexual contact as possible. It's just out of control. But I just think it takes their ability to try and save themselves to a new level where they might be able to genetically modify skin that might get dark to protect them from ultraviolet, but get white enough for them to still call themselves white, and all kinds of crazy stuff. And all of this stuff is going to be used to benefit white people, not black people. I thought that I think it was Red. I think that what she said about the clip with the opioid epidemic, yes, they were practicing racism profusely throughout that whole section. And excuse me. It's interesting because I think the epidemic really started from white people doing what they thought was taking better care of white people. Because in medical apartheid, when we studied it, they talked about the fact that white people would say that blacks had a higher threshold for pain threshold. So they would not give them painkillers or give them inadequate painkillers, whereas white people, they would give them any sort of painkiller that they wanted without any questions asked. And in their minds, they were thinking, oh, we're giving them the best of care, you know, because they're in pain. But the side effect was this opioid addiction. But it was really done on purpose because if you really study the history of this stuff, the military was guarding the poppy fields in Afghanistan. So they were the ones bringing the drugs here in the first place. And they just caught a doctor. I talked about this like 2 weeks ago, that made over $1 billion off of the opioid epidemic by paying doctors to give their patients opiates specifically. And he has done it with so many doctors across the country. He's a billionaire, and he's actually now going to be, I think he has to have a hearing in front of the federal government regarding his involvement in this opioid epidemic, because he's involved in just about all the major happenings there. So this is not new, and they were definitely practicing racism, and it ties into medical apartheid and the fact that we've been through this before. We've seen it in the 70s with the heroin epidemic when they were labeling us criminals instead of people with a medical problem that need help, like the white people are being labeled. So when you couple our experience with white supremacy regarding drug use and the fact that they were practicing racism, saying that we had a high threshold for pain, that's why we're not as addicted to opiates as they are. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Rod. Yes, sir, Mr. Steele.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele, and I am currently in Los Angeles, California. Wanted to report on some of the goings on with regard to some of the, I guess there's this wave of, or rather there's this movement of outing people for past indiscretions that may be associated with, you know, coming on to sexually onto other people in Hollywood. They're talking about this in particular throughout the media. And something that really struck me as pretty significant is that in the development of this whole story, there's one particular character named Louis C.K. He's a comedian. And his case is pretty interesting in the sense that he came out and basically admitted to all of the allegations against him to being true. Now, if I read the allegations correctly, he basically forced multiple women to watch him masturbate. And then in some of the stories, they include him physically restraining women and putting them in enclosed areas, notably a bathroom in one of the stories. So I'm trying to figure out why isn't he being charged with crimes? I know that all of his professional relationships have been suspended or have been severed. But, you know, we all know that that can be temporary. I'm waiting to see why there isn't a movement to make sure that these people are prosecuted. And then another thing that's really interesting is that many of the same people, especially within the comedy community, that were, people who were very adamant about making Cosby jokes and saying that Cosby was guilty without any sort of proof, and they didn't wait for any sort of a verdict to be read at any of the proceedings that were scheduled. All of these people I've observed, it's pretty consistent. The white ones especially are either silent or they are even sympathetic to Louis C.K. I remember seeing a post from one of my colleagues in the comedy space, a female who I remember making Cosby jokes and insisting that he was guilty. She said that the apology that he gave was, quote, perfect. And that's a word that, again, I've seen used to describe the actions of suspected racists on social media and other platforms. And I'm just saying, like, it's very, very telling how the difference between the reactions between Cosby versus the Louis C.K. situation. And it's very telling how there isn't really, apart from Harvey Weinstein, I haven't heard of police involvement or investigation into any of these people. Maybe Kevin Spacey, but I don't even know if that's the case. If that is, you know, feel free to correct my record. But yeah, this whole case, it's really disturbing, and it's very revealing how the system of white supremacy is working. I believe in the New York Post, there was even an article that said Louis C.K. is a pervert, not a predator. And then it went on to explain how he is not like Bill Cosby and Michael Jackson. And those are two names that I see that are brought up in this case a lot. Again, everybody is really seeking to attack the victims of racism that are implicated in these cases and give the benefit of the doubt to all of the suspected racists that are being accused of all of the sexual impropriety. And then I'm wondering, when are they going to admit that this sort of behavior is just white culture, as opposed to some sort of anomaly that is only occurring in Hollywood or only occurring in these particular settings? When are they going to come out and say, hey, this is just a sexual identity that we have? The clumsy sexual approach and the sexual assault method of procuring women or affection. It's really puzzling to me. And I guess I will mute my line at this time. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Mr. Steele. If we have other folks that we've not heard from at all, feel free. And the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Folks we've not heard from, if you have commentary, proceed.
Okay, I guess I'll speak. You can hear me, right?
Yes, sir.
So hopefully I won't use any metaphors this time because I know I screwed up a bunch of times last time I called in with regard to metaphors. But so I want to start off with this UCLA players, and I'm going to try not to take too much of your time. I know you want to keep it to 5 minutes under, so I'll do that. But the UCLA players, you know, I was online today. I was on Facebook, and I saw the post with regard to the black UCLA players, and I mean, you should have seen the comments. Maybe you have seen them from white people. I mean, like, it was like almost unanimous, like every single white person on the post was saying they get what they deserve, and you know they deserve to be punished, lock them up. I mean, it was there was no remorse, and I'm still not even convinced that they even did anything. I mean, maybe they did something, but I mean, who knows? It could be a misunderstanding. But these white people, they're not waiting for any evidence to come out. I'm reminded of when when the Olympian swimmer, Ryan Lochte, when he got into his trouble, I remember white people on some of those TV shows. I remember on the Today Show or one of those morning shows. I think it's Billy Bush was the host of one of those morning shows. He was trying to give Ryan Lochte the benefit of the doubt. And I remember Al Roker saying, no, you know, Ryan Lochte should be punished. But, the point is you do see the contrast in the way that the black suspects and the white suspects are being treated. And another thing I noticed, you know, with the bashing of the black UCLA players, I see not just white men, but I mean even white women going after those players. I mean, so, you know, you see how white men and white women are really able to stay on code. And I think often we see white women as allies or something of that nature. But that just doesn't really, I'm not sure that's really the case. Another thing I wanted to touch on was I know you brought up the Star Trek actor, the non-white male. He looks like he's probably quote unquote Asian, but you brought up his comments on Clarence Thomas and saying that Clarence Thomas is a clown and blackface. And you know what, Gus, you're absolutely right. Why did he feel the need to bring up to call him a clown and blackface? I mean, the decision that Clarence Thomas made was with regard to quote unquote same sex marriage. What does Clarence Thomas's skin color have to do with same sex marriage? So I thought that was really interesting that Star Trek actor would make that comment. And I'll tell you, I see this type of behavior from non-white, non-black people all the time. And I think as, you know, as melanated people, I think we should have a healthy suspicion, obviously of white people, but I think we've got to kind of keep our guards up against even other groups of non-white people. I mean, so I think that's just something we have to be careful about. And then I'll make one last comment with regard to the opioid, whole opioid epidemic. You know, it's interesting how even the name itself, I think, is embedded in racism. In racism, I mean, opioid. I think just the naming convention of it is racist. I mean, it sounds so innocent. You know, honestly, I made a joke once. I said it sounds like candy. And so, I mean, you know, so I think racists are very good at the way they at being able to portray things a certain way to make them look more innocent than what it really is. And so, but I think that's I'll end my comments. I think I'll end my comments there. Thank you.
Yes, sir. I would only add the logic in terms of what you said about quote unquote keeping our guard up. With other non-white, non-black people, that is probably sound logic even for other black people under the system of racism, white supremacy. There are a lot of black people who have been equally contaminated by the system of racism, white supremacy. There's a lot of anti-blackness. Other folks we've not heard from at all. If you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. This is Mahanji. I was calling about, I was listening to a number of black speakers just speaking on their predictions of what's going to happen in the next number of years. And there's black people giving predictions into, you know, 2050. and beyond, the year 2050 and beyond, of white people still being in power and still having white supremacy over us, and we still all being subject. Of course, that's what it means to have white supremacy, is we all still are subject to it. But, you know, I'm just wondering, like, why hasn't any of the black speakers given scenarios where we defeat white people within much shorter time frames than, you know, the next generation from us or something, or try to wait for them to die out after, you know, three generations or something? You know, it's just, I wonder why haven't any of the black speakers given, you know, real scenarios of, okay, if it's what's to happen in a year, okay, this is everything that would happen. This is what the risk would be. This is what we would do if it was X period of time. This is what we would have to do. I wonder, you know, what the situation is. And then the other thing is, I've learned a whole lot from watching different YouTube videos and looking up on Google a subject called preppers or prepping, where white people are preparing for, I guess, less government restrictions on their ability to kill black people, or however you want to call it. Maybe they're preparing for a quote-unquote civil war, or whatever it is, they're preparing for a period of time where they're able to kill black people with more force. And so some of the things, like, they're telling me all these different, you know, just looking at the videos, they're saying all these different guns that they suggest that their white people should have, every white person should have. They were saying, like, the guns I saw, the top guns were something like AR-15, the shotgun, Remington 870, Glock handgun, and the medium, I think it's like a Glock 17 or something like that, because you choose all these guns based on how prevalent it is, how many purchases have been made. If there's a war, you know, people want to have gunfights. You can imagine after things go really bad, people are having gunfights. You can go and pick up those magazines of those guns, and that's what these white people are saying in the videos. They talk about different food that they should prepare, how much food you can prepare for how many years, how to purify water, and how to live out in the wild, how to figure out booby traps, and ultimately how to kill people is what they're talking about. And then the other thing I was wanting to say was, and like there's a number of solutions, you know, whether grandiose or not. Like, we could all tell white people not to reproduce. You know, whatever opportunity that you get, to tell as many white people as you can, you know, as you think that you won't be killed, you know, tell as many white people as you can, do not reproduce at all. Let you be the last generation. And it actually would work that they stop reproducing. And then the other thing is, as I said before, heating up the environment to a temperature that albino or albinism cannot exist, however melanin can exist for a period of time. There's certain animals, like this group of bees, who will attack a hornet that is a scout, and they'll cover up the hornet and warm up the temperature, the core temperature of that little ball of bees, to a temperature right above what the hornet can withstand. But the bees can only withstand a temperature just a few degrees above that. But anyway, they killed the hornet by raising the temperature of it as it formed this ball. A few bees died, but ultimately the hornet dies, and scout's not able to go back and tell the group of hornets where the bees are located so the hornets can come and kill the bees, so the bees were able to defend themselves. So there is a temperature that albinos cannot tolerate, and that people who do not have albinism can tolerate. And the last thing that I was wanting to say was, as far as been said before, to share the content of this show, you know, how serious do we think this problem is? You know, the cold months are here now, and they're wrapping up with their, maybe, how do I say it? They're making plans to move while it's very cold.
and maybe they'll wait a little longer. I don't know. But, you know, we can take the time as the grid is up to share this content. There's, what, 40 to 50 million black people, and I don't know how many, what percentage is actually being reached by this content. And we have the ability to change, you know, this ourselves. We can actually make the change. Thank you.
Appreciate that. I guess in response to your first question or query about why when you hear other black people talk about this problem and a timetable for when we can solve the problem, and I guess you were saying that people were talking about times in the future, like 2050, I think you said, or even maybe years after that, where the system of white supremacy is still in existence. It's been my experience when we've talked to non-white people, black people specifically, most of them think it's going to take a very long time to solve this problem. I even remember guests that we've had on the problem who said that they think it's going to take 10,000 years to solve the problem of white supremacy. So I think that could be one reason, is that a lot of, or I'll say it this way, very few non-white people think this is a problem that can be solved in a short period of time. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, lines should be open. Proceed.
Not be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. There was a couple of terms that I was looking up. The first one was, there was a like an interview that was done here locally, I guess, with some radio station hosts, and it was about this I guess they call it anti-fascist, and like I know this word being used was starting to be more frequently used. And it's like, when it comes to like the letters in the word, it definitely reminds me of the word racist or racism. And it seems to be used by white people at a high rate when they're referring to, non-white people being the victims of racism. They'll use the word fascism, and it's a word called anti-fascism, or, you know, this white person was on this radio show saying that he was an anti-fascist. And from what I remember, like, the other white guy asked him what was the definition, and he said it was something to the effect of it's a nation of people who have a populist agenda or something like that, and it connects with capitalism. And it has mainly targets minority groups of people. So, like, when they start talking like that, it definitely can get confusing. And I don't know if he's speaking in code to other white people, but this person definitely seemed like he was well prepared to speak about this word fascist or fascism. And toward the end of the interview, he was saying, well, you know, just because, you know, somebody has a bald head, you know, doesn't make them a Nazi. And just because someone is throwing some kind of projectile in the street doesn't mean that, you know, that he a fascist, or all fascists throw things in the street. Some of us, you know, we donate to charity, very confusing type language. And the guy who was talking had a very calm sounding tone. But I'm thinking that, I think that's the agenda, to get a lot of black people using that term fascist instead of racist. It's a very similar word, similar syllables, you know, but I think it start with an S instead of an R. And that term, the black identity extremists, and then, you know, Richard Spencer, he using the term identity politics, but you know, he a white person and he using the word identitarian, but you know, nothing really following him, you know, as a white person. And he did a interview with a black male, I guess a British journalist, and there was a section of the interview where he was talking about this so-called white ethno state. So, you know, the black guy, he asks him, he says, you know, a safe space, like, why do you, you know, why do you need a safe space? And Richard Spencer, he says, well, why do Jews need a safe space? Why do, you know, such and such need a safe space? Like, he didn't answer his question. So he asked him two questions while answering his question. And then, you know, the black male started answering his question, you know, very slick with how they talk. You know, so that's one of those tactics that they continue to use. And he still likes to bring that, I think his name, Mike Enochs. And the one female that a couple of weeks ago, she definitely, I think, used some form of codification. And she was saying, no, you know, hey, I didn't ask you the question. I asked Richard Spencer the question. So he gave the microphone right back to him. So just wanted to point out some of those things. And that's all I have right now. And thanks for allowing me to speak.
The legend Richard Spencer. I saw one of his interviews from this week as well. He's crafty. That is standard. In my view, that is a standard one to be expected tactic of racist white supremacists. When you ask them a question, they respond with a question. And for a lot of non-white people, they get us. We end up responding and talking and talking, and they evade ever answering the question. Not surprised. Richard Spencer is not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. Do we have other folks that we have not heard from at all? Anybody that we missed completely have a hand up who wanted to share? Oh, another caller down in Florida. Princess, did you have commentary, ma'am? Maybe she's just listening while we wait to see if Princess is sharing. Did we have other folks that we missed completely? Any folks that we have not heard from at all have commentary?
Give me just a moment.
For sure. That was Princess. Thought she might need a second. While she's taking her moment, did any other folks have commentary?
I'll be heard.
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, Mr. Gus. How are you, sir?
Right
greetings
poorly.
To all the callers. Right poorly as well, Gus. Right even more poorly. I want to do say to you, though, you know, you have the best show anywhere on the planet, period. Most productive show, period. And I claim you to be the king of counter racism, Gus. That's your title. The Catholics vs. Convicts. I saw the documentary a long time ago, a while back. And mind you, Notre Dame has a huge white leprechaun in the middle of their football field in a fighting stance, like he's about to fight. Looks sort of like McGregor. The victims in this whole thing was the University of Miami players who were called convicts, who were already, like firefighter said, going to this university. They didn't really want black people, but they wanted a good football team, so they sent them there. And they made the victims in this documentary, however, the white boys who made the racist t-shirts. You know, their roles of doing this t-shirt and making, I think, $30,000 selling this Catholics vs. Convicts t-shirt and the punishment that they got. And then their life went on. I mean, one went on. Oh, sorry, my earpiece fell out. One went on to be like a senator or something. I mean, they had a great life. I mean, they you know, they got suspended or whatever. It was just a mockery. To Puff's question, the police here In Jersey, they do it a lot, but in New York City, I don't recall them ever asking for money to support their 60,000-plus strong police force here. And they always, every year, they're breaking in record number recruitment. So, but what we do have here that I never realized in Jersey, when I lived in Jersey, and I'm not sure if it's just the cable provider I have, but we get these emergency broadcast things that's the loud, you know, thing that goes across. And if this was an emergency, you know, that comes on about 2-3 times a day, which I think is, like, ridiculous. And I always wondered why. The ball, the lane, one of the balls got arrested in China. Now, just to put the balls in context, you know, they became media sensations because the father wanted to establish a company for his sons, a sneaker company, which totally goes against the grain of how things work in white-owned sports. If you're not signing a contract with Nike, Adidas, Converse, Jordan, Reebok, or one of Fila, whatever, you know, that's what they expect from you. And they expect to make a certain amount of money and pay you tens of millions, but they're going to make billions. So here, this young man already has his own sneaker in college. He's driving a Lamborghini to college. He's not a poor young man. However, he gets caught up going to the store with some of his friends, and someone tries to steal some Louis Vuitton glasses. Now, why would you want to steal Louis Vuitton glasses from China? You should have found a place where Chinatown gets their fake Louis Vuitton glasses from. Y'all probably could have got a pair for $1. They sell them for like $5 in Chinatown. They look exactly like the real ones. Now, from what I understand, they come from the exact same factory. But, you know, I think that, of course, the media here is going to make it all about him. And this is one of those things, I think, where you have to watch your friends. I used to have friends that I would go places with. And when we get back around the neighborhood, they're pulling stuff out their drawers, like, you know, stuff that they've taken. And I just make a mental note, never going to the store with him again. And, you know, this is what happens. From what I understand, that they're talking keeping them for 2 weeks. And like someone said earlier, let's contrast that to the swimmers who vandalized Brazil and peed all over the place. And I haven't heard a lot of people advocating for them from the states, in particular the University of UCLA, which has a lot of power. The only person I've seen advocating for them is the guy who owns Alibaba. I guess you could call him the Chinese version of Zuckerberg or Eric Bezos, but he just bought into an NBA team, so he's speaking up like, oh, these are kids, they make mistakes. He sounds like the same talking points the white owners would use. But no one's saying that, you know, this is ridiculous, you're keeping them for 10 days for a pair of glasses. China, you know, you make all those things. It's not like you guys are really that needy. I just think they're going to make an example out of them. Last part on that, what really shocked me from the article I read is that the Boyle family has their own reality show that plays only in China. China just renegotiated. They will ask the father was there when renegotiating the contract to shoot another season of this reality show. And they picked it up. And this happened. So I just thought that was ironic as well, because they're not showing that here in the States. And I think that would be, with all the crap they show on reality TV, to show a black father starting a business for his sons and how they run it. To me, that sounds like something way more constructive. And I just had another one of my terms I wanted to add into the context, and I could do that after you get to the callers that I haven't spoken, guys. Thank you.
Appreciate that. The only thing I wanted to add on the Catholics versus convicts, I didn't think of it because I didn't know about all of this. You know, this is from, I think, 30 years ago when all this happened. But they did not mention the hypocrisy, the gall for the Catholics to be talking about anybody being a criminal. Catholics the religion of white supremacy. I mean, you're talking about an institution notorious for raping children, like widespread Jerry Sandusky's and them covering up and hiding it. I mean, wow, I would not be calling anybody. I mean, how about maybe we take Catholics out and put child rapists versus convicts or convicts versus convicts, if you want to be truthful with the shirts. I mean, any folks we have not heard from at all? Are there folks we missed? Anybody that we have not heard from? Oh, Princess, did you need more time? Forgot about that.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good evening. I just wanted to share my recent experience. I've been searching for an apartment. And I was trying to stay on this side of town here in Ocala. And I had went to one place, Crosstown. And initially, you know, saw the place online advertised. And overall, when I got there, I just immediately... it was a legitimate developer and stuff, and so that wasn't the issue. It was just it was a white female receptionist there, and it was almost as if when I came in right away, she was already trying to size me up and determine, I guess, whether or not I would be going to whatever particular unit or being shown this, that, and other. And so I eventually, you know, did the application and this, that, and other, and was just getting conflicting information. Once I saw the apartment, I later found out that it wasn't even the original apartment that I had viewed on the online. One of the big things that I brought up was the fact that the advertisement clearly stated that it was a ground level apartment, and it was on the second floor. And I really don't like second floor apartments because I just, as far as moving logistically, I just want to be able to, you know, go in and out. But nonetheless, you know, it was just certain things that I, you know, was just kind of perplexed about, and it didn't dawn on me until I went back and was looking at the advertisement that I realized that this wasn't even the same unit that, you know, I was inquiring about. So I've just been playing, I was, up until I found something else recently, I was playing this waiting game with them for them to call me back to go over everything. You can go online and view, I guess, your status because, you know, they do their credit and background checks online through TransUnion. Smart Move, I guess the app is. And so, you know, like I said, it was just a very odd experience. Just, you know, trying to find a place and having to go through these hoops to, you know, secure a place to live. And I think that's it. I don't know if that made sense.
Absolutely. Mr. Fuller talks about racial dislocation pretty regularly in terms of non-white people not being able to have reliable, safe space to live, exist, just making it difficult. Or you get a spot and then they say, oh, you got to move, finding just lots of reasons to keep us on the move and making that another source of stress for Black people. I think last week when you called in, I think when Roz, when he was offering some great suggestions on how you can relax and replenish from all the stress, and you were talking about just the difficulty of not having a spot to do all of that, that is racist design. If folks, do we have folks that we missed completely? Any of the folks that we've missed completely? Emmy, if you had commentary, if folks had any suggestions for Emmy or folks who are dealing with these sort of problems when they're out looking for a residence, that would be great as well. Emmy, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everybody. I think there was a few things I wanted to comment on, but there's just one thing that I feel like I just have to say, which is why I'm chiming in kind of late. Regarding the Mariah Carey situation, right now it's what I'm about to say is pure speculation, but there could be some justification to it. If she only prefers black bodyguards, now if one could say that maybe she prefers black bodyguards, maybe she's more attracted to black men, so she wants to be surrounded by black men, or that black men are supposedly like more aggressive or something like that, so she feels safer. But I also think that there's a possibility that she might want to be surrounded by black men because she feels safer, but not because of some kind of violence or aggressive stereotype. But that I know that she's non-white, and I think she might have a white parent or whatever, but I'm sure that she has seen a lot, has been in a lot of situations. I'm sure that she's very much aware that she's not white and that there's a certain level of comfort, I think, I could be incorrect, to being surrounded by other non-white people when you're not white, even if you're not all the way black. I don't know the correct way to say it, so forgive me. And when that's not talked about, and so what I'm saying is not just specific to Mariah Carey, but when that's not talked about, I think a grave injustice is being done, or deception is being practiced, because to make it seem as though there's something incorrect about non-white people, specifically black people, feeling safer around other black people, taking that completely out of context and not giving some, like not speaking about it, number one, and then providing some type of information as to why that might be, is not correct. And because there's, you know, when you've been mistreated by white people for so long, and you're constantly mistreated by white people for so long, and given the current obvious temperature or climate, I don't know if those are metaphors or not, but given the way that things are now with Trump in office and post-President Obama's time in office, I could see that as legitimate. You don't know. These white people could be doing anything. And since they're in a close, you know, if they're in your hotel room, they're carrying your bag, they have access to so many things. And so you just might feel more comfortable with other non-white, specifically black people. And I might have missed it. Maybe they talked about it, but I don't think that they did. And I think just to jump immediately to say, to start adding some type of fake conversation about reverse discrimination or whatever, it's totally different. If I've been mistreated by a group of people for so long, I feel more comfortable and safe by the other group of people or the group to which I belong, non-white. I don't know if you all are understanding what I'm saying, because I might not be explaining it in such a linear, like concise way, but they jumped to saying that it's some type of reverse thing when really it's a protective thing. Thank you. That's what I wanted to say.
That does make sense. I think she was married to a white person, a white male first, and then they got divorced. So it all could be exactly as you said, her making sure that she is safer in her career. We have other folks who had comments, anybody that we missed or any other folks who had comments they wanted to get in. I think we got all the folks who had a hand up. Maybe I'm in error. We missed anybody, you should speak up now. If other folks had comments, if you've already shared and you had additional comments you wanted to get in, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
My greetings to you guys and to Emmy and the other callers as well. There was a movie I came across that just, and I'm not a movie person, but this one just blew my mind when I saw it. It's called The Diary of a Teenage Girl. And in lieu of all of the different pedophilic sexual deviance that has just been exploding. This movie is white culture on display. It's about a 15-year-old girl who starts having sex with her mother's boyfriend. And it just goes on this adventure of her having her virginity broken by her mother's boyfriend. And the way that it's presented is presented as a viable relationship. And they also give the teenager at points in the movie license to act as if she has a controlling stake in this relationship. And then later on in the film, she makes a joke with the main character, the male character, the mother's boyfriend, makes a joke. This is a joke, saying she's going to tell her mother. And then he turned it on her and said that she was controlling him by threatening to tell her mother. And I was just watching this whole thing play out. And I'm like, I used to always wonder, what is the mental state of Quentin Tarantino, Stephen King, all the people that make these really twisted movies, whether it's sexual deviance, violence, horror, gore, all of it, just to have the mindset to create something like this and call it art. And in this case, you're actually presenting pedophilia as a relationship scenario with the child being given some sort of false sense of power. It is just white people tell us who they are in every area of people activity. And watching this was just incredible. It was disturbing. I mean, they didn't show anything crazy as far as just anything explicit, but the concepts in it are disturbing. And I think it gives serious insight into the way the white mind works and functions. And also this evening, there was a documentary that came out on Jeffrey Dahmer. It's called Dahmer on Dahmer. And it was on the Oxygen Channel. And it's a series where they're basically having him speak about himself, showing how he got caught, everything behind the scenes, but they're actually getting full footage from him, directly filmed from him. And it's quite fascinating. I know you've done a couple of shows regarding Jeffrey Dahmer. We know that Neely Fuller, the illustrious elder, has stated that he is one of the greatest, if not the greatest example of white supremacy and how it functions was Jeffrey Dahmer. This documentary is incredible, but it's called Dahmer on Dahmer, and it just came out tonight. Wow. And this Diary of a Teenage Girl is just flabbergastingly fascinating. And it shows you white supremacy on a level that's just, I think, unprecedented and quite explicit. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. Did other folks have comments here they wanted to make sure they get in? Last, we have about retired firefighter.
Yes, sir. This is... in reference to a Welsing, Dr. Welsing analysis. I will first name the issue. It's called, once it goes back to this football game, it's called the turnover chain. And a turnover chain is something that was created, I think, this year in football. You know, something to motivate the players, in this case the defensive players. I don't know exactly where it started at, but I'm looking at the University of Miami Notre Dame game, and it is given to a defensive player if he makes a turnover is like an interception. If you didn't know, I'm talking to people who may not know, if turnover is when on defense you get the ball back from the offense. That's either through a fumble, an interception, from that standpoint. And what this player gets is a huge gold chain. Now, I'm pretty sure it's not actually gold in itself in real, but it mimics, it may be, I don't know for sure. Whether it is or whether it's not essential. But actually, what I'm seeing with this gold chain, it's once again coded for black males, young black males, primarily. I'm just looking at this and having a Welsing, Dr. Welsing type of analysis with this, and primarily, you know, with University of Miami. especially University of Miami football players. 95 to 98% of them are black males, and every last one of them on defense is a black male. So I'm thinking, you know, what's next for a turnover? You get a watermelon or some bananas. You know, the next, as far as the next idea, I really don't see any difference between the two. I mean, between the three. Although they're saying they're calling it a turnover chain, you know, just something. It's a thought as I was. I've learned, especially through this program, I've learned to watch television with the sound off, especially a football game. I don't need to hear someone talk about football as long as I've been around it to watch a game. And that's an analysis that I had by watching this game. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to comment on a couple of other things, or I wanted to elaborate on one thing and then answer Puff's question. I know back in Ohio, I think it might have been the police. I know for sure, of course, there would be people asking for money. It might have been either firefighters or law enforcement officials. But also, it was funny because when I was back in Ohio, I had got a call from Nevada, and it was someone from like a police or a law enforcement official office asking for money. So at least in the past, what I've occurred with here is in Nevada is that they will actually call you. Not sure how they even got my number, but they were soliciting donations that way. The other thing that I did want to elaborate on was just the book study. What I was basically trying to, I guess I didn't get it out correctly, was that with the segment, since I did finish the book study, is that it's really making me pay attention to how white people, when they are speaking about racism, how they take these, I guess, verbal cues from each other, especially when it came to, I noticed a lot when it came to the segment about the two black males who were killed by the Klan in Mississippi, how it seemed like the white journalist, and I forgot exactly the wording, but how she was basically saying, you know, well, how could this be? How could, like, you know, this cold case happen? And then, the documenter, he would basically, you know, kind of offer a sympathetic answer, but then also back it up with, oh, well, these people aren't, you know, we really can't, they really couldn't help it because of, like, I guess when he was talking about, like, the federal, the FBI, well, it wasn't really their fault because they had other things going on. One of these other excuses. So that's what I wanted to say. It's definitely helping me better understand how they are practicing racism and how they are making sure that everyone, even in your speech, even if you're supposed to be talking about racism, how you're still supposed to speak about it in a particular way. Thank you.
Thank you for that elaboration, Red in Nevada. I think that's absolutely correct. And I think white people, they are phenomenal, exactly what you said. And I think you can have whites that are strangers. They've not, like, talked to each other at all before. They've never met each other before, but they can just pay attention to word usage. When they're speaking, they can be speaking in front of another black person, other non-white people, and just that alone can be enough for them to understand what's happening and what they need to do to make sure that they dominate that situation. They are outstanding with just being able to use words and pick up on verbal cues in the semantic environment. Absolutely. Other folks, if you had Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Yes, I got to get Red. I'm used to Red from Nevada. And I'm so used to Red from Ohio. With the firefighter said, man, it's a rapper from New York named Cameron, who he has a line where he says, back in the days, we were slaves, whips and chains. That's tradition. Now all I have is whips and chains. So they know how to you know, a car and a chain is how they get a black person, unfortunately, a lot of times, to do their bidding. I wanted to talk about a term. Now, this is not a mental disorder. This is what whites suffer from. It's a genetic disease. And I call it terminal sexual deviant syndrome, uncurable. It encompasses rape, pedophilia, bestiality, sodomy, homosexuality, bisexuality, transsexuality, et cetera. And I saw over the last couple of weeks, we've seen nothing but white people coming out and all their sexual deviant behavior being exposed. The best they could come up with us is Bill Cosby. Everyone else is just like, they might have cheated on their wife or had a baby out of wedlock, but nothing like what I'm seeing coming out of the white Hollywood and even political people that they're doing. I said last week, and I stick to this, in this particular instance with the white Hollywood and being that whites suffer from this degenerate disease, these women are complicit. They know what the game is before they play it. I know that's a metaphor, but they understand the rules of Hollywood. You know, you don't walk into the room and see the knee pads there for nothing. So they know what's going on. And this, just think about this. What's come out, I mean, this is probably every actress in Hollywood had to compromise themselves to get the role they got or to get the commercial they got. Or little boy stars, you know, it's got me looking at them like, well, did their parents sacrifice their, you know? But also, a huge part of this, now, when you look at the legal definition for a minority, and it's a state or condition of a minor, infancy, and you look at the legal definition of a majority, which means full age, the age at which by law a person is entitled to manage, mint, they put that as two different words, management of their own affairs and enjoyment of civic rights. So according to Nellie Fuller, who is a genius, he says that black people are not boys, are not men and women under the system of racism and white supremacy. They're not going to be allowed to. White people aren't going to allow it. They allow them to be boys and girls. And therefore, I also add as a part of sexual deviant behavior, interracial relationships, because that is essentially pedophilia. That white person is not sleeping with another adult. It's not an adult decision being made by that black person. That is an infant, a minor, a child that you're sleeping with, and you have all the control in that relationship. And I don't even think I could call that sex anymore, Gus. I think I'm just going to call that, I'm going to have to find a word to put in front of pedophilia, but definitely that's a pedophilic act. Anytime you see that, when I see De Blasio with his wife, that's pedophilia. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
New York's finest, Mr. De Blasio. Other folks who have commentary that they would like. One thing I did want to make sure I did not forget, I think with these accusations, one thing that I would be mindful of, at least the pattern seems to be that when the people that have been accused thus far, I'm thinking of Mr. Weinstein, Louis C.K., Kevin Spacey, the white fella at NPR, most of the people that have been accused over the past year or so, either they have admitted or it hasn't been, you know, hotly contested. You haven't had, you know, furious, like, disputes that, you know, this is all a lie and that sort of thing. I would be mindful that in a system that is run primarily through deception, racist man, racist woman, they have a history of making false accusations, particularly false sexual accusations against black people. I would be very careful if these accusations continue, if there end up being non-white people accused. It would not surprise me at all if there end up being some sort of false allegations in all this, because it just seems like for the most part, people have just accepted what folks have said, that they think this is true. The people that, you know, have come out and made these accusations, I would just be mindful of that. Racists, they have a long, long history of false sexual allegations against Black people, males, females. I would be very mindful. Last 5 minutes.
Also, Gus, I just want to say, man, no one's going to jail or court yet either. They didn't get dragged through the media storm like Bill Cosby. I mean, even when you look at Ray Rice, I mean, how many times a day did they play the video of him dragging his wife off the elevator? We don't see that type of play taking place with all these white people, and they're admitting to doing some of this stuff. So I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Any other final?
May I say one thing?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. The one thing that keeps coming up in my mind about the Louis C.K., I'll never forget, I was flipping through the channels, and he had this one particular part in his stand-up where, and every time what Gus talks about when people say the N-word, his whole stand-up, and it was, you know, just I feel like it was an example of him practicing racism. He said, you know, I hate it when you're watching TV and people say the N-word, just say nigger. And he literally said that like 4 or 5 times. And it's like, you know what, ever since then, it's like I've never, you know, he's a suspected racist, probably a racist in my opinion, but I would not be surprised that, you know, because of his ability to practice racism so blatantly. And I don't recall too many white people laughing in the audience, but I think that's the reason why they're not putting him under as much scrutiny, because he is a part of the white team. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Roz.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you going to say something? I'll let you speak first.
No, sir. Proceed.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to point out something that Thomas in New York said that is, I think, extremely important. When he was discussing the legal definition of majority and minority, it reminds me of Neely Fuller when he says that Black people and white people don't speak the same language. We might be using English, but the meaning of the terms are different. Because for the average non-white person and Black person, when you hear the term minority, we are taught that it means that we are less numerically, we are the lower number of the two. So white people make up the majority in the sense of there's more of them than us. But what he said was a minority really says legally you are a minor, a child, and also minor in importance, but the main thing is minor as in a child, versus when you are called the majority, you are considered a full-fledged adult. We really have to think about that when we use the term and when they're using the term, because they're telling us just what he said. When you see these so-called interracial relationships, it is pedophilia, because they have infantilized the entire group of Black people and other non-white people who are subject to them. So because of our infantilization, anytime you see a white person with a non-white person in a so-called tragic, well, not so-called, in a tragic arrangement, so-called interracial relationship, it is basically a rape relationship. Thank you so much. I'll mute my line.
Right on. And unless somebody had a comment that they can get in about 60 seconds.
Read an article about melanin. They said that white people are now injecting melanin into their skin to fight melanoma and skin diseases. I would love to know where they're getting the melanin from. I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Medical apartheid. We shall be here. I really enjoyed Neil Postman's Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk. Like, I'd read it before, and we've read books on the book club that I've read before, but it had been some years since I had looked at that book. Really enjoyed it. Hope other folks benefited from Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, and some of the suggestions about word usage and things that can make you more efficient with your use of words and a better listener, more attentive to things that people are saying around you. But new book, The Wisdom of Psychopaths. Dr. Niana Rasayan, he recommended this book. This was like years ago. And somehow we never got around to it. We were supposed to do it. It was very high. It would always come in like top two. Just never finished first for whatever reason when listeners voted for which book we were going to read. So that is one we will go ahead and take care of. We'll be starting it brand new this Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. It's written by Kevin Dutton. He is a racist suspect born outside the States in England, but written in English. Came out, the book is relatively new. It came out within the last 5 years, so I don't imagine it would be that difficult if you want a hard copy, but Dr. Rasayan highly recommended it, and I think he even gave us a great synopsis of the text on one of his previous visits. But that'll be the text for Friday. We'll be here for Workplace Racism on Thursday. Just check at Black Talk Radio Network or the Facebook page for updates for all of the program times, dates. If you get confused, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Thanks, everyone, for tuning into the broadcast. Appreciate everyone who called. Share the broadcast. If you have social media, you can tweet it, put it on Facebook, Instagram, wherever you hang out at online. Share the content if you think it would help non-white listeners get a more accurate understanding of what white supremacy racism is, how it works. Help us get this problem solved as soon as we possibly can. That said, I will again encourage sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Racists, they have exploited a lot of non-white people worldwide and for centuries. Because they were intoxicated, could not think correctly, could not make the best decisions. I think Dr. Welsing and quite a few other folks that we esteem, they would strongly recommend that we preserve our brain computers, remain sober so that we can think to the best of our ability and produce concepts to the problem, racist man, racist woman, racist child. If you are going to consume any intoxicants, I would recommend getting to one spot and staying there. You do not want to have to be out and about in a vehicle. If you are not sober, you never know when you might bump into a Daniel Holtzclaw or another race soldier, badge or no. That is not a time when you want to have deficient thinking because of what you have consumed. Buckle up as well. Make sure I remind folks that if you're in a vehicle, driver or passenger, seatbelts. Do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.